Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Today is the 19th of the 12th month, 2025. It is a Friday evening and the time is 5 minutes past the hour of 9. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Pulling Heartstrings. This is the creme de la creme, ultimate drip, cherry on top, icing on the cake, the whole cake. I'm the table where the cake is chilling and I'm definitely the tiles where the table, the cake, the icing and the cherry on top are chilling. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking this past few years, right? And I think that we've been talking and talking and talking and talking and also listening. We've done quite a bit of listening along the way. And for that, I appreciate it. I appreciate us for talking. I appreciate us for bringing issues onto the table that, really affect the ordinary Namibian and not just a certain class or a certain group of people. And I appreciate that. So if you would like to participate, the number in studio is 0832888401. That is the number in studio in case you would like to call in. So ladies and gentlemen, today I was thinking about all the relationships that I've started with social media. And I've been thinking about all the relationships that have gone wrong. Now, one thing I do know about us is that we don't really bring our dirty laundry to the table. We don't talk about what goes wrong. We only talk about the romantic stories. Have you ever seen how a couple that is met on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, wherever, Or they say that Tinder is aka prostitution in Namibia, but I wouldn't know that, right? But I've heard from the grapevines. So Tinder, we can include Tinder anyways. So have you ever seen those couples that tell their whole story? And part of the story is that we just met on Facebook. It was a comment. And then after that, we started DMing. And then after that, it was lunch. And then after that, it was, you know, a relationship. And then after that, it was, we are together and we're getting married and we're having babies and it's a happily ever after. And we hear those stories often. And some people, because Facebook is not, or because social media is not really, it is not yet accepted within our group or our class of our era, right? It's not really something that is announced a lot. So most people meet on social media and they now come and tell you things like, no, we met in town, we met at church. They come and cook up a story because all of a sudden it is now embarrassing to tell people that you met on social media. But I would understand why. I think it's because mainly our parents and our elders don't understand the concept of social media. They don't understand that people really honestly have lives on social media and have a whole following on social media and really honestly just go and interact with other people on social media. I think that in most cases, it is assumed that we as people must go outside there and meet people and talk to real life people and, right? That is the concept of mingling. But we have taken it up a notch. We have taken it to a whole new level. And that whole new level is called social media interactions. And with social media interactions, ladies and gentlemen, it is more about having conversations within the comfort of your own home, within the comfort of your own environment, or within the comfort of your own emotions, feelings, and whatever you are going through. So you might be hella depressed, and you're still functioning on social media, or you might be hella busy and functioning on social media, actually having a social life, because sometimes in real time, it's difficult to interact with other people, especially the older we get, the more complicated it becomes to have interactions with other people. Now, with other people, I would mean like real life people in terms of exchanging words, you know, in looking at each other and looking at body language, seeing and talking to another person. That is what I'm saying. So many people don't want to talk about it. They don't want people to know that they have met on social media. And I understand why. I understand why, because unfortunately, in as much as we would like to believe that we are an advanced species, an advanced nation, an advanced people, we still have very much primitive ways, and we definitely do have unorthodox beliefs, and we also have orthodox beliefs, and we also have customs and so forth that we follow religiously. And part of those beliefs and customs and norms is that you are supposed to know the person, and social media doesn't cut it, apparently. And it's understandable. We are a little bit backwards, and for those that are ahead of their time, they are feeling it. They feel the kicks and the punches coming from society. And that is why many a times couples choose to lie. They choose to omit. They choose to forego. They choose to not mention why, where and how exactly they met. But it is social media. So with that, I would say that there are advantages and disadvantages of being in a relationship that started on social media or is on social media. And one would have to also look at the concept of infidelity, especially for those that are married. Now, part or in monogamous relationships, or so their partners think. Because sometimes you think that you're in a monogamous relationship, but your partner did not sign up for monogamy. And you are caught in the crossfires of love triangles or octagons and hectagons, etc. Or stop signs, etc. So infidelity in itself is basically stepping outside of your monogamous or assumed to be monogamous relationship and entertaining another party in a romantic manner. In a romantic manner does not necessarily mean or imply that it has to be physical romance. It could be conversation, and that, or intimate conversation, or sharing of information that is not for the general public or is not necessarily something that you should share with every Tom and Harry, but you share it with this person because there's a level of comfort that comes in, and that would be classified as emotional cheating. And that is what is happening a lot on social media or on these social media platforms. And one would argue that it is hoville on social media, because it seems as though many a times people, everyone, if not the whole letter, is absolutely single on social media, or they give the impression of singledom on social media. And it is understandable to some degree, because many a times, right, we try and differentiate between a realistic life, a life of reality, and a life that is invented. Invented to soothe your ego, to stroke your ego, invented to somewhere, somehow create an image or a persona that you might be following. Now, I'm not talking persona non grata. I'm talking about a whole entire personality. Have you ever seen how someone lives a certain way on social media? And when you meet them, they are complete opposites of what you assumed them to be from the marketing. I would call it marketing, false advertising that they had now, right, chose to display. You would think that somebody is extremely moneyed, somebody is extremely successful. And then when you see them in real life is a set of sandals, not even the good kind. A set of sandals, a t-shirt here and a shorts over there. And it is not even the good kind. It's not the brand of clothes that they display. And that's not it. One would say it's false advertising, but that is what you signed up for by following these particular individuals. And in real life, you might think that, okay, or in the social media world, one would assume that because of how this person comments, because of how this person conducts themselves on social media, one would assume that in real life, this is exactly who we are. Because I would think it is absolutely ridiculous to have a personality somewhere, to have two personalities. I would think that it's absolutely ridiculous for you to have two personalities where apparently social media is just social media. It ain't nothing but a thing. And yet on social media, you are marketing yourself or advertising yourself to be a bachelor or a bachelorette. But then in real life, you're a whole married Zali that is at home with 10 children, a whole loving husband, and you wear church dresses and church skirts and etc. That is now what we say, double lives, right? It seems logical for us to dictate, or it seems logical for us to assume it to be double lives, because you are one person, but you have two different lives. And part of these lives is that, over here in real time, we classify you as a family man with children. No foul language, no dirty remarks. And we put you on a pedestal as father, as husband, as boyfriend, as uncle, as cousin. And then on the other hand, we know you as the dirty dog from the gram. We know you as the dirty dog on the Insta. We know you as the dirty dog everywhere, because the things that you talk about are extremely dirty and extremely offensive. Now, those are two different people, I would like to assume. But I would also like to say that the reason that I believe that most people have two personalities, especially one on social media and the other in real life, is because secretly they are both. And it's not two different people, so they're not living two different lives. This person's thoughts, this person's remarks, this person's hypocrisy, because I think that, okay, for the most part, or in most cases, when I analyze and scrutinize people that I assume to have double lives, I see a lot of hypocrisy within their social media character. I see a lot of premature conversations. I see a lot of premature reasoning. I see a lot of preteen kind of reasoning. And I would hate to assume that somebody's child got hitched to this person and decided to copulate and had more children with this particular individual. So it must be a facade, right? But I would also say that it is not a facade. It's really honestly just how the person is. You might say that you go on social media to talk smack, right? But you had a social media page for the past 10. Most of us have had our social media pages for at least 16 to 17 years. Same page. Sometimes we lose the password, but it remembers. Sometimes we don't even use the email address anymore, but it remembers, right? So I would like to believe that the smack talking that you smack is exactly who you are. It's only that deep down inside, you know that it's wrong to think the way you do. It's wrong to display that type of hypocrisy. It's wrong to display that type of immaturity. And it's wrong to display that type of, I wouldn't say stupid. I would say less intelligent, right? Remarks that we put on social media. A lot of people say that, no, the life on social media is absolutely something different, and that's just social media. But unfortunately, as life is continuing, and even though we're still a developing country and we are still very much backwards when it comes to technology, and we're still at the back, we're trying to catch up. We're trying to catch up, but at some point, eventually we'll get there, but we're not there yet. You must know that the character you display, regardless of how many times you make yourself feel any better, people that want to find you will find you. And maybe that's why your life is so messed up. So there's this meme of a girl that is not shaped according to the way that I would like women to be shaped. And she doesn't have the looks that I would like women to have. Right? So that is me, toning it down a notch, basically. So she's not according to my standards and according to my taste. She's not my kind of woman. She's not my cup of tea. I don't like women that look like that. And she's laying on a mattress, like it's a dirty rug mattress, kind of dirty. And she's on a phone with her legs in the air and hair not done. And the meme reads as, me judging people on the internet while I look like this. And that for me is the true depiction of what's happening here. Now, the reason that I'm talking about social media tonight, and the reason that I'm really honestly diving into it with my time and at a different kind of pace, is because I would like for us to discuss a conversation. I would like for us to discuss catfishing. Now, catfishing in itself is a person. When we say catfishing, we're not talking about you fishing catfish, right? No. You know, the dictionary has two kinds of meanings, and we're not talking about the literal sense. We're talking about pretending to be somebody. Pretending to be somebody, sending somebody else's images to another human being and display and false impersonation. Yeah. False impersonation of another person. So catfishing would be me, right? My face in your DMs talking about love, and you fall in love with the image that you see. You fall in love with every conversation. Now, this person might absolutely be charming. This person might absolutely be drop dead gorgeous, but the image that they have displayed is not an image of them. Now, this happens a lot of times, especially in countries such as the United States, for example. They have a lot of catfishing situations where the Nigerian brothers are laying on that mattress with laptops in their lap talking about, I'm an Ibubuchukwu prince and I just need $10,000 to, yeah. That's catfishing. And the picture that is sent is not an image of them, but an image of an actor. Imagine an image of Gaza, for example, is circulating. Picture this. There might be a woman out there that has printed out a picture of Gaza, a couple of pictures of Gaza, and put it in frames and put it in her house. And let everybody that comes over know that this is her fiance from Abuja. Now we know Gaza is not that woman's fiance from Abuja, because one, Gaza is not from Abuja. Two, the man is married. So we know this, but she doesn't, right? And every day, they are interacting. So it's now the guy behind the picture that is not Gaza, right? He's using the picture as a front. And then over here, he's talking. So it's phone calls, but no video calls, right? No video calls, because if we're going to video call, then you're going to see that I do not look like my images. I do not look like my pictures. So there's always a network crisis. There's always a situation. There's always a reason that we can't video call. And that's how catfishing works, right? So she's having a conversation with this guy for a couple of months and she's head over heels. And this guy, this gentleman decides that, you know what? You're the love of my life and I want to marry you. I want to bring you to Nigeria. You know? And you're like, oh wow. or she's like, oh wow. And usually it's soft targets, you know, soft targets. Sometimes they do target even you, the wild and beautiful, but sometimes it's soft targets. Sometimes it's somebody that genuinely just wants to be loved by another human being, that just wants to feel butterflies as well, that just wants an opportunity to be loved and love. And many a times people prey on others' desperation for love in order for them to find the money, you know, because at the end of the day, what we're talking about here is usually just for money. And if it's not for money, sometimes it's really just low self-esteem. And in this low self-esteem, I can't show you what I look like because I know that you wouldn't like me if I showed you what I look like. So I'll send you an image of Gaza. You fall in love with that image, but you still keep talking to me. Now it happens a lot. It happens to guys. It happens with guys in jail, you know, with guys in jail. I remember there was a friend of mine that was having this conversation with a particular person. And the conversation was immaculate. It was good. It was the type of conversation that she longed for in a very long time. It was intellectual. It was witty. It was absolutely beautiful, to say the least. And she had started fancying this particular individual because of the character traits that he had shown through their conversations. But this particular individual could never answer calls. He could not answer calls. And also, he couldn't text for long. And he couldn't also interact as frequently as she would like. And then one day, this was after like 2 months of them interacting fruitfully, one day she asked him why he could not answer the calls at some times and why he wasn't active online. She asked him the necessary questions, right? And she also followed up the question with another question of, or are you married? And he was quick to dismiss that he was not married. And there was truth in his voice. And then she said, then you must be in jail. And he took a pause. And that pause in itself was the answer. He was indeed in jail. And that is how you get catfished all over the place. Now, a lot of us are being catfished and a lot of us are falling into traps, right? We're falling into traps with different individuals throughout the walks of earth, of life. We are falling in traps of catfishing where somebody is not what they said they are, or he's not who they said they are, where somebody's using somebody's image. And that is going all over the place. That's why it's so dangerous, right? To keep uploading pictures of yourself on social media, especially when you have a whole entire gallery. I found a page of myself the other time and I was so astonished because I was like, oh wow. I made it to the big league. but one can only imagine, right? What they use your images for. And I understand why people have officially started making their social media pages private, because it is not fun to bump into a whole image of you and they are saying, this is Cassandra from Kasai. And you're like, what? I know Cassandra from Kasai? No. So catfishing is deceiving someone online by means of fictionally or an assumed persona, especially with the aim of luring them into a relationship. So that is what it is. It's deceiving someone online, you know, by giving you a fictional idea. So sometimes it's Cristiano Ronaldo that's inside your DM. Sometimes it's Idris Alba. Sometimes it's Vin Diesel. Sometimes it's Jennifer Lopez. Sometimes it's whoever. Now, if you don't know who these people are, then you might fall for it. You might be looking at a whole hand and you're like, I want to smash that. You see? Luring you into a relationship. So now you get into a relationship with this person and bam, you know, you never know why they catfish. So there was a nurse from Umthia and she had started a relationship with Boothang, and it was an online relationship. It was a social media relationship. And then they took it to the WhatsApp, you know, they took it to the person in line. So they started talking online and then they moved to cell phone numbers. And with this one, it wasn't really, I wouldn't say it was catfishing per se. I would say that it was more about intention. What was this particular gentleman's intentions with this lady? So, they had eventually arranged that, you know what, babe, because it's relationships, right? We only lure them in with false hopes of relationships, right? So it is a situation of, babe, I'm in Ungwediva and I would like to see you. I would like to hang out with you for the weekend. And she's like, okay, no problem. I'm going to get paid and then I'm going to come and then what. So she goes all the way to Ungwediva. She calls the gentleman. The gentleman answers and he says, no, I'm a bit preoccupied right now. I'm going to send one of my friends, my homies, to come and pick you up so that, they bring you straight to me, babe. And she is happy about it. So she's like, Boothang, you know, got the kitty waxed and everything. dirty. And this gentleman picks her up, the friend picks her up. And when he picks her up, he takes her to an abandoned house. And that's where everybody is, including boyfriend. And they rob her. They don't just rob her of her belongings that she has. They also stage a kidnapping situation, whereas people in her phone book now have to send her money because of her situation. So, you know, so are you guys getting the drift of catfishing? Sometimes it's for a relationship. Sometimes it's just some person that has self-esteem issues that really wants to kick it with you and really wants to get with you and is hoping that their personality is enough for you to overlook the fact that they've sent you Jason Statham's pictures for the past 2 years. They're hoping that their personality is enough for you to ignore the fact that they were using Gaza's pictures in your DMs. They're hoping for that because in most cases, their personalities are actually quite beautiful. But somewhere along the way, somebody broke this. Somebody broke this individual. And somewhere along the way, this person is not as confident as they should be, or something happened and they don't look the way they would like to look, and or there's a disease of some sort or a dysfunction of some sort. We don't know why people do it, but they do it. So we're talking catfishing. We're talking catfishing. And my question is, have you ever been catfished before? Has somebody ever sent you images, right? And by the time you go and actually meet them, you're like, you don't look like your pictures at all. No, it's just because I had makeup. Yeah. And also another catfishing situation. You can call in and answer that question. The number in studio is 083-2888-401. So another catfishing situation, ladies and gentlemen, is also, You know how we looked better when we were younger? You know, some people age well. They age like fine wine, where it is, you look better with age. I think that I look better with age. Yeah, I think I look better with age. But also, like, I was also a stone cold fox, guys. Like, yeah, sometimes I look at pictures and I'm like, damn, ma, she can get it. Anyhow, so, have you ever had a conversation with somebody and you guys send each other pictures on WhatsApp, right? And the pictures that are sent, they're a bit oldish, but it's definitely the person. And it's like, wow, it could have been 5 years ago, 6 years ago, but they don't mention that to you. They send you the picture like this was yesterday. This was taken yesterday. So now you're having a particular image of this person and you have expectations of how this person is going to be. You have expectations of how they're going to, you know, conduct themselves. You have expectations. You find somebody that doesn't sound, look, or behave like an alcoholic or a deep drinker or a deep dive drinker. And, then, right? One, they don't look like their images. And two, they drink like a fish. And three, they have sloppy tendencies. I feel like that is the most heartbreaking thing for somebody that actually wanted a relationship out of the interactions that they had. And it happens quite often, especially for those that just want to drink people's money. They just want to chill. They just want to have fun. They usually, right? They usually take up a lot of people's hearts. And they disappoint people tremendously. And when they disappoint these people tremendously, it is bad because it leaves so many trust issues. And there's so many horror stories that come with catfishing. And that's what we're going to be doing today. We're going to be doing horror stories that come from catfishing so that we can hear and see. So there are particular people out there. You might not believe me when I tell you this, but there are particular people that have a preference in terms of they love people that are incarcerated. And then there are people that love men in uniform or women in uniform. And everybody has a preference out there. And everybody has a type. Everyone has their kink, right? But usually the people that like men in uniform or women in uniform are usually called bunnies. Because they just hop from one person with uniform to another person, to another person, to another person, to another person, to another person. And this might be disturbing because if they don't get it through to the one person, they might just get it through to the other person. And then you're sitting with a whole situation. So we're talking catfishing tonight. We're talking catfishing. We're talking about the life on the gram, the life on the Facebook, the life on the Twitter, the life on the Tinder, the life on the internet, and what to expect. What to expect when talking, when doing internet stuff, right? And I'm not here to scare you. I'm just here to have a conversation with you. I'm here to be in your ear. I'm here to articulate myself properly. I'm here to maybe, just maybe, stop you from making a mistake or encourage you to go for the person you love. But before that, let's take a quick breather and we will revert back.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its
Eagle staff. FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my cattle menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura, and I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6%.
6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. Mm. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past. Mm. And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM.
Ipuranenge no wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweko tete opoye ekukurile oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo ihewe tike kovano ile koshiwana konongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi to danjuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi nawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe faa omarudi tayo loka opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamoili nawa Ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile ko berewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafilane Eagle FM the eye.
Alrighty, ladies and gentlemen, today is a beautiful Friday. I hope you guys are ready for us to dive into the world of catfishing. So we're doing story time, ladies and gentlemen. And as we know, right, your girl is, you know, I'm coping. I'm surviving, so we're going to let others tell the story this time around, but I will tell you a story at the end as well. But before that, let's dive.
And I lived in a small suburb in the Midwest, full of ordinary people who didn't...
Before we proceed, ladies and gentlemen, please take note that we as Eagle Media House do not claim any ownership of the content that we are playing. It is strictly for our show's purposes, for us to broaden our horizons and to also see what is going on out there and to hear it from the horse's mouth. We do not claim ownership. Thank you.
I didn't quite share my interests in goth metal and David Lynch movies. So I often took to the internet to meet people with like-minded interests in hopes of some stimulating conversation. Add to that, I had recently come out as gay to a couple of close friends along with my mother, who did not take the news well at all. I didn't know any gay people in real life, so at the time the internet felt like the only place to meet other people sharing similar experiences. This was back in the days of dial-up, when it wasn't too uncommon for strangers to strike up an IM conversation based solely on their AOL profile. One day I received a message from a guy around my age named Steven. It started off pretty normal. We talked about our favorite music and movies, how much we hated school, and all the celebrities we thought were cute. He eventually revealed that he was 16 and was living with his older brother because his parents had kicked him out of the house for being gay. I thought it was cool to meet someone who lived nearby that was old enough to drive and didn't live with their parents, so we decided to meet up after a couple of weeks of long chat sessions. I knew my parents would not be cool with me meeting a stranger from the internet, so I lied and told them that he was a mutual friend of another friend they already knew and trusted. Once the plan was set, he showed up on a Friday evening in an old beat-up pickup truck. To my relief, he didn't look like a creepy old catfish stalker. In fact, he looked just like his pictures. Red hair, goofy smile, but definitely not unattractive. We went for a ride, grabbed a bite to eat, stopped at a guitar store, and caught a new movie at the theater. I was so excited to have a friend with similar interests who knew about the pressures of being gay in a small town and was happy to chauffeur me around. I decided I didn't want the fun to end once curfew drew closer and asked if he wanted to crash at my place. I had a trundle bed that pulled out from underneath my bed so he could sleep comfortably without the pressure of something sexual happening. After watching a DVD, we both passed out for about an hour when suddenly there's a loud knock at the front door. My parents awoke to find a police officer, also a friend of the family as my dad was a retired cop, standing at the door. I went out into the living room to see what was going on, and he proceeds to tell us that they received an anonymous phone call that someone in our house has been communicating with a wanted pedophile. My parents went into my room and where my computer was and forced me to downgrade my AOL account to kids only when my new friends slept soundly nearby. I told them I had no idea what they were talking about, but since I was pretty much the only person using the internet extensively in our family, they said I would be banned from regular use until the mystery was solved. The next day, Steven and I were out for a ride just enjoying the day, when all of a sudden we were passing an oncoming SUV who slammed on his brakes and did a squealing 180 only to begin tailgating us and honking his horn furiously. I was screaming at my friend to slow down and asking if he knew what was going on. Who was this crazy person behind us? He didn't say a word. We wound up in a high-speed chase that felt like hours, but probably only lasted about 5 minutes. Stephen finally pulled over and jumped out of the car and motioned for me to follow him, so I did. As we're getting out, the driver behind us headed straight for me and went to punch me square in the face, but stopped mere centimeters before actually hitting me. I pulled away from his shaking fist and saw a man in his 30s with eyes bulging out of his head, literally. I much later realized he had Graves' disease, which if any of you had seen what it looks like, it's nothing short of terrifying on an angry man about to beat you to a pulp. This man went on to tell me that my friend was actually 21 years old, and that he was his boyfriend, and that I needed to stay out of their lives if I wanted to live to see tomorrow. Once the initial shock and confusion wore off, I was absolutely broken. Scary Graves guy took off with Stephen and left me in the dust. I made my way home and didn't say a word to my parents, just locked myself in my room and cried harder than I've ever cried before. I felt pretty damn stupid and ashamed for being so naive. I hoped that the whole thing would just blow over without anyone ever finding out, but the story didn't end there. My older sister and I had our own landline phone number separate from the main house phone that we shared, and kept that answering machine in my room. I came home from school one day and noticed my mom was already home, which was odd because she didn't usually get home from work until a few hours later. I went straight to my mom to find a new message on the machine. It was the Graves dude, who went to leave a voicemail, but my sister had picked up mid-message so I could hear their conversation over the recording. He pretended to be a faculty member of my school and asked for my mom's work number. He wound up calling her and giving her a detailed account of just who exactly I had been hanging around with. I went out to the back patio where my parents sat, looking just absolutely devastated as they informed me two FBI agents were on their way to get a report about my experience with Stephen, who, by the way, wasn't actually named Stephen. It was a fake name he had given me. Once the agents arrived, they informed me that he was wanted for alleged molestation of two children, one of them as young as 10 years old. Needless to say, I was sick beyond belief, and angry to boot. I complied with everything they asked me to do and agreed to testify against him on.
And that is why we must protect our children from the internet. Yes, we must protect our children from the internet because there are creepy, 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 creepy people out there that are willing and more than able, right, to take advantage of them. I think that children shouldn't be on the internet in the first place. I think that we should wait until these children are at least 16 for them to have social media platforms. But now the children are having social media platforms because apparently it's ways to make money. Their parents are the ones that are running the page, and eventually they get to run their own page, and guess who they're talking to?
In trial, I wasn't going to let this liar get away with hurting any more kids. And apparently the other families involved were so embarrassed they didn't want to testify, leaving only me to do something about it. Around this time, I received a late-night phone call from Stephen's boyfriend, asking if I was okay, checking up on how I was doing, and eventually turning the conversation around to a more flirtatious tone and complimenting me on my musical tastes, appearance, etc. At this point, I realized that this wasn't just a jealous, possessive boyfriend involved in a game of cat and mouse, but rather some kind of partner in crime who reveled in younger boys just as much as his disgusting significant other. I quickly hung up and never spoke to him again, though he did attempt to call me a few more times after that, according to the caller ID. Fast forward 1 year when Stephen's court date finally arrived. I went to the courthouse downtown with my mom and was informed by an attorney that he took a plea deal and would be sentenced to jail for 1 year. Yep, that's right, folks. He only got 1 year because his victims refused to come forward and testify. Another year later, I was 16 and finally had my own car along with a great group of supportive friends. I had pretty much buried this memory far away in the deep recesses of my mind and never really thought much more about the encounter. Until one day I started receiving IMs from an unknown screen name. These instant messages consisted of death threats and facts about me that he could only have known from driving by my house and stalking me, like what kind of car I drove, the types of clothes I liked to wear, and what my daily schedule primarily consisted of. This went on for a couple of weeks from various mystery handles, sharing in explicit detail how I was going to die. I was pretty freaked out and kept a close watch wherever I went. However, I never saw him creeping around in spite of the heightened awareness of my surroundings. I eventually printed the items out and shared them with my school principal along with the police, assuming no doubt it was Stephen attempting to contact me again, hell-bent on revenge. After filing a report, I luckily never heard from him again. I don't know what became of him. I don't even remember what his real name was. I can only hope something truly horrible has happened to him since all of this transpired. This is a story I kept from my friends for a very long time, and to this day many people in my life don't know about it. It's still a delicate subject, but a story I felt compelled to share. I've since received counseling and live a very happy life as a 28-year-old far, far away from that dreadful little town, and any stranger who attempts to contact me on Facebook gets blocked immediately. The day before I received the first text, I had been at a festival. Being the reckless 16-year-old that I was, I got too intoxicated and don't really remember much. I somehow made it home about 9 a.m. the following day, and around probably early afternoon, I wake up to a text from a random number asking, "Who is this?" Now at this point I was terribly hungover and out of it, so I guess this text was from someone I embarrassingly gave my number to at the festival. So I text back asking if I met them last night, and he says he couldn't remember. The conversation is pretty much normal for a small while as I tried to work out who this person was. I eventually asked him if he could send a picture of himself so I could try and remember talking to him the day before. He asked me if I received the picture and I didn't, so then I just asked him for his name. We'll call him Jack, but this name didn't ring any bells to my hungover, still half-drunken self at the time and stupidly kept talking to him. I was asking all the people I went to the festival with if they remembered a guy named Jack and nobody knew, so it was pretty weird, but I was hanging too hard to think straight. This is when things started to sound a bit off to me. He asked how old I was and where I lived, to which I answered and asked him the same. He told me he was 17 and lived in the same place, so I took it as they were someone in the exact same situation as me, unable to remember who they met last night. Now, what he said next might ring alarm bells for others, and almost rang mine, but things like this are asked a lot by desperate boys around my area. He asked if I was single, and from that point on I really didn't care for speaking to whoever this was, so I ignored them and went back to sleep. I woke up again, slightly less hungover and thinking more straight. I remember reading through my texts with Jack and something clicked. I felt a bit uneasy as I remembered a few months back one of my friends used a guy named Jack's phone from her work to call me, and the day after he wouldn't quit texting me until he said he'd delete my number, and I had heard nothing since. I immediately texted her, asking if a guy named Jack still worked with her and if this was his number. She replied saying yes, and I swear my blood ran cold. I even started to think I was dreaming or something, because this is the kind of things you hear and you never expect it to happen to yourself. I sent her screenshots of my text with him, and she seemed really creeped out, telling me he was a dirty man in his late 50s, and that he had been sending weird texts to another one of her colleagues, far weirder than those I received, but I won't mention what they said out of respect for her privacy, and was a bit of a creep to her in person, too. This shook me up a bit, so I told my mom, who was absolutely livid. She told me if he contacted me again that she'd call the police. Fast forward to a few days after, I was in town waiting for my mom to pick me up and take me home to change for work when I got a text coming through from Jack. I was thinking, oh God, not again, and opened it to see a picture of some teenage guy with, "Did you get it yet? This is me," or something afterwards. I knew this wasn't him, so ignored it and told my mom when I got in the car, and we called the police when I got home, and they arranged to visit with me when I got home from work, which was quite late. My shift finished around 10 p.m. They arrived and my idiot phone had reset itself, causing me to lose all my texts and pictures, so I couldn't even show them the text from before, but could show them the recent ones of him asking why I wasn't replying and stuff along those lines. As the police were on my phone, he texted me, which I found quite funny as he was unaware who they were being viewed by. We shared the information about how he had harassed the girls I know who work with him, and as much as we knew about the guy, and they said they'd dig up some dirt on him and take a visit to his workplace. They said they couldn't do much about the text because it wasn't classed as harassment due to me ignoring him instead of telling him to stop, but what he'd done to the other girls was enough for them to take action. After they left, I texted him asking him not to text me again, and he replied with something like, "Why? What did I do?" but never contacted me again after that. The police knocked on my door a few days after, telling me they were going to visit him later on today and would tell us what happened after. If I remember correctly, this whole thing is kind of a blur in some places as I don't like to think about it much. They never got back to me, but luckily for me, I got all the gossip I needed from my friend who worked there. She had let everyone know about what he had done, so pretty much everyone else working with him had been avoiding him, and I think he got quite angry about that. Apparently, the police came in and requested to talk to him in private, and they took him outside. When he came back in, she said he was very grumpy, obviously from the telling off. She soon found out that the picture he had sent me was of his own son, which is so completely messed up. His son found out what he had done and threatened to beat him up, rightly so. Finally, the workplace fired him, and I had to do a statement for all their evidence so they could win if he took them to court. Last thing I heard of him was that he moved well away from the area, which relieved me so much as I like to take walks most days down to where he lived, which refrained me from doing so out of fear. There are some other things I should mention for me added to how creepy it was, but I wasn't sure where to put them. In between the time gap where he first texted me after my friend used his phone and when he texted me after the festival, I went down to the workplace to speak to the owners about getting a job there. At one point, I was sat smoking with pretty much all of the other staff outside, and I was sat opposite to him. This makes me feel so uneasy because that whole time, he must have known who I was, and maybe him seeing me then made him want to try to catfish me or whatever. My friend also told me at the time he was trying to send the fake picture of his son. He was walking around the workplace trying to find stronger Wi-Fi to send it and getting really frustrated. And one more thing. One thing that I just found out was that he had tried contacting me on WhatsApp. I was looking at his Facebook profile and I recognized his profile picture from a message I got off of some random guy on WhatsApp, but I shook it off as those random messages you get sometimes. Ew. I don't recall what date he sent a message on there, and I don't have that app anymore, but I thought it was worth noting. I actually feel a lot better after writing this out, and I've been meaning to for some time. What scares me the most are what his intentions were with me. I hope this has taught him a lesson and stopped him from thinking that he can just try this with anyone else. I had just moved to London, and being a bit lonely and wanting to get into the dating scene, I tried the whole OkCupid thing. It was alright. I honestly wasn't too active on it. I'd check my account a few times a week and message some profiles of girls that I thought were pretty. 95% of the time, my messages would go unanswered. I guess it was mostly because many of my messages, in retrospect, were pretty uncreative and dry. One day I was messing around looking through various profiles, when I saw an extremely attractive girl and decided I had to message her. In my opinion, she was a perfect 10. Not just the fact that she was a gorgeous blonde, but we liked a lot of the same music and movies as well, and I could actually send her a decent email because of all the things we had in common. I also need to reiterate that her pictures were smoking, which most likely definitely clouded my judgment, and I should also mention that I'm a former military and Afghan veteran, so nothing really scares me. Almost immediately after pressing send, she responded. We messaged each other through the OkCupid messenger service for about a week, and I got to learn a lot about her. She had an interesting name, Aoife, and she was from Belfast. She told me she had a daughter named Rosend, which didn't really bother me, and had a very long, complicated story about how she grew up a Catholic in North Ireland during the Troubles and was orphaned at a young age. She seemed really driven and had such an amazing story. I had so many questions, and in all reality, a lot of respect for her, so it was really easy to keep talking to her. Within about another week, we started talking on the phone, and then sometimes on Skype. She'd never do an actual video chat, which at the time I didn't think was too weird, but she sent me pictures of her and her daughter, friends, etc. For the most part, this whole thing seemed legit. The stories she had were pretty detailed, and she was talking about stuff that I really didn't know a lot about, and honestly couldn't comprehend. Then there were parts of the story that seemed to get kind of weird and didn't add up. At first she told me that she was a hairstylist at some swank place in central London. I don't really frequent central a lot, so okay, no biggie. I just met her online. I wasn't going to head into central to stalk her at work. Then she said she owned a bar in Camden called The Lock Tavern, which I looked up on the internet and is a real place, and managed it on weekends. She had details about the bouncers and regulars. This didn't seem to make a lot of sense, but okay. I mean, I guess you could do both jobs and be a full-time mom. It seemed odd, but she seemed driven, and she also seemed really hot, so who was I to judge? Again, I wasn't going to be super creeper and pop down there. I just took her word for it. She also said she lived in a really nice penthouse near Covent Garden, which, if anyone knows the London real estate market, didn't seem plausible on a hairdresser barmaid's wages. She explained this by saying that she had fallen into some money after the troubles. It seemed kind of far-fetched, but, again, without actually meeting her, who am I to judge? I started to notice some other weird things. She'd send me pictures, and in some of them certain tattoos were present, and in some they weren't. I figured she was just sending old pictures, but I remember that is what started to tip me off that things were fishy, to say the least. But again, there's really nothing wrong with sending old pictures, and I had no real reason not to believe the photos were Aoife. They all seemed like the same girl, and with the exception of the tattoos and some small changes in hair color, nothing really seemed out of the ordinary. She would also send me pictures of her daughter, Roisin, who she claimed was 14. Finally, after talking to Aoife for a few weeks online, I asked her out on a date. I figured it was time I finally meet her. We're set to meet up on a Friday night, and on that Friday she doesn't respond to a single text or call. I had nowhere to meet her. By around 9 p.m. she texts saying things got out of control at her pub, and she was really sorry, but she had to cancel. I was upset and should have bailed there, but I forgave her and we agreed to set up another first meeting. Things from here really started to get weird. As I said, I was doing the online dating thing, and this time I'd met a few other girls. Another girl named Jo had asked me out. I went out with Jo one night in an area of London called Shoreditch, which isn't too far from where Aoife's pub was. While I was out, Aoife called and texted me a few times. I basically just ignored the calls. When the date was over, I said bye to Jo and went home and called Aoife. She asked where I was, and basically, well, I lied. I said I was out with a friend. Aoife didn't say anything, and we talked on the phone for a bit and then said goodnight. The situation got strange a few nights later when Aoife caught me in my lie. She claimed that she knew that I was out with another girl. She knew which restaurant I was at and the night that I had been there. She knew what Jo had looked like. Aoife claimed that one of the bouncers from her pub knew what I looked like because she had shown him photos and he recognized me when I came through the doors at the restaurant in Shoreditch. This didn't make a lot of sense because I didn't see any bouncers at the restaurant we were at, but maybe he was bartending or something, I didn't know. She had details, and they were spot on. This was odd, to say the least. I basically told Aoife that the date was set up before I'd even met her, and that we weren't really dating, so she had no right to be upset. Plus, she stood me up, so if anyone should be mad, it's me. To be honest, I forget what really happened in this part of the story. I think we fought for a little bit, didn't talk for a few weeks, then one night she called me really late. It seemed off, so I answered. She was panicking. From what I could tell, she was suffering from sleep paralysis, which I know is scary, so I stayed on the phone with her until she went back to sleep. This happened a few more times. I really had no intention to date or even see her. I went home to the U.S. for about a month, and while we did keep limited contact, there was nothing too serious, and my expectations were pretty low. After I'd gotten back to London, she invited me out. I don't remember much of the details, but she ended up canceling on me again. I basically decided, screw it. I wasn't even upset. We'd texted a little bit, but the communications really started to die down. I really didn't think much about it and went on with my life. Then one night, I entered the Twilight Zone. One day I was in the King's Cross, St. Pancras area with a friend of mine from the States. He had to make a meeting nearby, so I was by myself in the area. That's when I got a text from Aoife. She asked if I wanted to meet up, and I figured, hey, might as well finally meet this girl. I was in the same area of town, two stops away, and didn't see any harm in it. She told me to meet her up in Camden, and she'd be at the Wetherspoons pub at noon. It wasn't a date, at least in the romantic sense, which was good, and at this point I was really curious as to who she was. I'd literally spent hours talking and texting this girl. So I don't know Camden that well, and I'm getting texts from her on the way up there as I'm trying to find the Wetherspoons. It's right by the lock in Camden, by the way. She's telling me she's at work and in the process of selling her share in the bar, but she's on her way. Another friend of hers is at the bar, but he's a great guy, you'll like him. Again, I was already right there, might as well meet her friend. That's when I meet Reese. Reese was a tall, skinny ginger kid. He was about 21 and had a thick Irish accent. I walked up to him, shook his hand, and we got drinks. He seemed nice enough, and for as weird as the situation could potentially be, it wasn't all that uncomfortable. Another one of his friends was there as well. They seemed like two nerds in their early 20s. They talked about football and video games and all the other stuff 20-something-year-old kids talk about, mixed in with a little bit of politics and a couple random questions about, how do you know Aoife, etc. I'd been in Afghanistan fighting the Taliban a few years prior. This situation wasn't anything to be concerned about, I thought to myself. Then I got a text from Aoife, something along the lines of, hey, getting tied up, be there in about an hour. Reese seemed nice enough, so we hung out, got a few beers, and moved on to the next pub. Still no Aoife. Reese and his friend were nice. We did rounds, and fortunately I hold my beer pretty well. Another apologetic text from Aoife rolls in. Screw it. We're drinking, I thought, and we're having a good time enough. Reese would ask me random questions about Aoife, but I basically shrugged it off to being one of the only few things we had in common. We bar-hopped around Camden and went to the Holly Arms. At one point I was in the queue to buy a round of drinks and felt like this guy was way too close to me. I turned around and saw an overweight old man with an ugly brown jacket and a pockmarked face. He had a crucifix tattoo on his neck. In all honesty, a typical barfly you'd see in a British pub. I said, excuse me, and walked past him. We continued to drink and blow the day away. By this time it was like 2:30 to 3 and Aoife's nearing 3 hours late. I decided, screw it, let's go to the Lock Tavern, her bar. Reese and his friends seem cool with it. We get there and there's two Irish tricolors flying above the place.
Yeah, you can tell Aoife owns the place, huh?
Reese said. The part of the story kinda added up. We went into her place and I text her to tell her we're there. Oh great, I'm almost done. I'll be down in a minute. She never comes down. But this is when the story gets really, really weird. This other dude named Pete shows up, shakes Reese's hand, and Reese says,
oh, you're here to meet Aoife.
Keep in mind that Aoife and Aoife are phonetically almost identical names. I look at Reese and he's like,
ah, this must seem weird. Aoife is Aoife's best friend.
Now this seemed really weird, but I needed to figure out what was going on. These two girls have almost exactly the same name, and I had never heard Aoife mention Aoife before. I start talking to Pete, and Reese starts asking similar questions to him about Aoife that he was asking me about Aoife. But some of these questions were getting more serious. He was asking him things like, do you love her? Pete's story then starts to sound eerily similar to mine. Pete meets Aoife online. She's from North Ireland, has a daughter named Roshan. In his version, she's 12. He tried to meet up with her a few times, but it fell through. He was invited last minute to hang out. Oh, that's weird, is all I could think. Something wasn't right. At this point, I knew that someone was getting played, probably me, and I was in some kind of game but needed to figure out exactly what was going on. Pete and I started to figure out things right about the same time, and right in front of Reese, who stuck to his guns in the story remarkably well.
They both have similar names. They both have daughters that are around the same age with a really common Irish name.
I'm not buying it. Neither is Pete. I decide that the pub we're in right now might not be friendly territory, and I don't want to get shanghaied in Camden, so I suggest we leave. Aoife sends me a text saying she's almost on her way. Great, I said. Meet us up the street at some other pub. Pete and I start walking out. On my way out, I ask the bartender,
Hey, is Aoife working today?
He responds,
Nah, mate. Aoife hasn't worked here in 3 years.
At this point, I know something really, really creepy is going on. We head to the next pub. I've got a good buzz going, but I know I need to sober up, and sober up fast. I think Pete might be a victim in this game too, but he might not be. He for sure can't be trusted. Reese and his buddy are suspected as well, but I don't have any proof yet, and my curiosity is keeping me there. We walk into another pub. Reese's friend says something to Reese, and I don't hear it. Neither does Pete. Reese loses it. He yells at his friend, and his friend basically says, Screw off, I'm out, and takes off. Pete and I are still trying to put things together. I find a table on an outdoor deck. It's quiet. I can think, and I can piece this together. It's amazing how fast you can sober up when you think you're in trouble. I ask Pete if he has any pictures of Aoife, and Pete pulls out his phone. He shows me a picture that I'd seen before.
Wait, that's Roshan.
Aoife's daughter.
No, mate. That's Aoife.
Pete replies. This is making no sense. I've been sent the same picture of the same girl and been told it was Aoife's 14-year-old daughter. I showed Pete pictures that I had of Aoife. He claimed he'd never seen the girl in the photos before. Reese was sticking to the story that I had pictures of Aoife and Pete had pictures of Aoife and that he wasn't sure why I thought the pic was of Roshan. He also kept claiming that Aoife and Aoife texted him and they were on their way. That's when it dawned on me. I simply looked at Pete and asked him,
What number do you have in your phone for Aoife?
Pete reads the number on his phone, and it turns out being the exact same number I had for Aoife in my phone. If all the other clues hadn't added up, this one sent it over the edge. It also sent Pete out of the bar as he literally jumped over a table and ran out the door in a panic. It was actually quite the sight to see. At this point, it was just me and Reese. I don't think that he had overheard that we both had the same number for someone that he was telling me were two separate girls. Reese said that Aoife and Aoife had texted him and that they're on their way. I don't know who Aoife and Aoife are at this point or if they even exist. I basically tell Reese that I think he's playing some kind of messed up game and that he's more than suspect of wrongdoing. He wasn't a big dude and knew that if he stepped to me it wasn't going to end well. I basically walked right through him, knocking him into a door frame and tore out of the bar. I headed straight for the tube. I needed to jump on the northern line and get home. I wasn't waiting for anything. At this point, I had no idea what was going on. At best, I'd been in some sort of weird manti-teo-type catfish scam. At worst, I was also a victim in a snuff movie. I get on the tube and there's a guy right behind me. I look at him. He's overweight, pockmarked face, brown jacket. We make eye contact. I look at his neck and there's the crucifix tattoo. It was the same guy from the Holly Arms. I'm a bit worried, but I've been under worse pressure before in my life. I calmly sat down in the train. The train was being held in Camden for some reason and wasn't moving. That's when who jumps on the same carriage as the two of us? Reese. I could have sworn he made eye contact and gave a nod to the man in the brown jacket. At this point, I played dumb that they were there. On the London tube, there's a certain dinging noise that's made right before the doors close. I waited to hear that noise, then bolted out of the door. I ran around and doubled back on the tube several times. When I finally got back near home, I texted a friend, Newcross, and told her I was scared and I was being followed. She was having a party that night and invited me over. I really didn't want to head home alone. At this point, I think I doubled back and switched lines enough that if Reese and the man in the brown coat were following me, I'd lost them. I made it to Newcross safe and sound. I had a few calls from Aoife the next few days, but I never wanted to answer them. She also sent a few texts saying we needed to talk. Eventually, she stopped calling and texting altogether. I have a few theories on the whole situation. One of my friends thinks that Reese and Aoife are the same person. I wouldn't rule it out, but the person I talked to on the phone definitely sounded like a woman. To those of you who are dating online and meeting sketchy people, be safe about it. Never let your curiosity get to you like it did me. If there's anyone out there who has any idea what was going on, feel free to share or play your theories off me. I'm still baffled by the whole thing. I am an almost 28-year-old gay male who was born and raised in the Appalachian Mountains, which for my friends not in America, that's in the south, more towards the mid-Atlantic region. I usually don't just throw being gay out there, but it's important to my tale and to understanding why I made such insanely poor choices in my teenage years. I know almost everyone does, but this really takes the cake. Follow me back to when I was 16, just about 12 years ago. I was a junior in high school, had plenty of friends, and no trouble with bullies. At least not while I was at school. My parents are now wonderful people who greatly regret the way they treated me when they found out I was gay. At the time I hated them for being so horrendous to me, but as I got older I finally understood that their reaction was just a product of the strict religious movement they, and myself, were brought up in. My parents, who at the time firmly believed that this would send my eternal soul into damnation, pretty much only allowed me to stay at our house a couple of days a week after that. For at least a year I was living on friends' couches and off the kindness of their parents. I was in what I can only describe as the worst state of miserable major depression I have ever been in my entire life. I have tried to commit suicide the year before with a very serious overdose that cost me 9 days in the ICU. I should have died, but your liver is an amazing thing and it started to regenerate on its own. A year to the day after that, literally to the day, the first guy I ever fell in love with was killed in a tragic car accident. My parents had zero sympathy for my feelings. They were the immoral feelings of their blasphemous son, so they didn't count, I guess. I remember coming back home from his funeral that night and my father asking me, "Why are you so upset? Were you dating that boy or something?" I didn't even respond. Just walked right past him and straight into my room where I proceeded to cry myself to sleep. Again, don't judge them too harshly. They were different people back then. Needless to say, this sent me completely spiraling downwards in the worst possible way. Drugs, alcohol, you name it, I did it. Anything to stay numb and keep myself from feeling the immense amounts of pain I was in emotionally every single day. To have your situation go from a year before seeing your father cry for the first time as you lay dying in a hospital bed, to him spewing so much malice and hatred towards you, let's just say it was enough to make anyone have a mental breakdown. I had friends who cared about and loved me deeply. I don't know why that wasn't enough. It just wasn't. I felt like no one truly loved me or ever would. Hell, if my own parents couldn't then, what were my chances with finding a soulmate? Would I just be alone forever and as miserable as I was then? At the time, in my angsty teen mind, that's exactly what it felt like. Which finally brings us through my background and mindset leading into the pure, unadulterated hell that was soon to follow. In the midst of my deepest, darkest despair, the brightest idea anyone has ever had on this planet popped into my head. Well, if no one around here will ever love me, then I'll just go online and try to meet someone who will. Pure stroke of genius, right? It just made absolute biblical sense to me at the time. I felt like the only gay teen in the whole damn state, like the only person who really understood me, was me, and only ever would be me. That in order to find someone to love me, I would have to search far and wide beyond the borders of the mountain fortress I had resided in my entire life. Proud of myself for having such an ingenious idea, I immediately hopped on my MySpace. Facebook for us old people, for all you young folks saying, "What is MySpace?" and spent the next hour making it as cool-looking as I thought I could. You could customize just about everything on your profile, so of course mine had to accurately reflect all my emo feelings in the darkness of my soul. Word to the wise, and something I wish I realized back then, if you're trying to attract the darker things in society, you're probably gonna get back exactly what you're sending out. I know I sure as hell did. It all started out innocently enough. I clicked on one of my gay acquaintances' profiles, and for some reason, this guy on his top 8 just flew right out at me. His name was Jacob. He was gorgeous, dressed in all black, and that was pretty much all I needed to know at the time. I saw he was from Maryland, several hours away from me, but far enough to possibly not be like everyone else here. Far enough to hopefully have exactly the kind of mentality that I was looking for in another human being. So I sent him a message. Something lame to the effect of, "Hi, what's up? I saw you on my friend's top 8 and thought you were cute, so I figured I would say hello." I wasn't expecting a response, none whatsoever. He was so gorgeous and seemed way too cool for me, so why in God's name would he message a guy like me back? And then it happened. Within a minute of me sending my message, I got one back. It was from him. Not gonna lie, I exploded in joy on the inside, something that I hadn't felt in years and years. It was just something like, "Hey, you're cute too. How old are you?" But it was enough to send me over the moon. I felt alive again, but what I really felt was hope again. We talked the rest of the day and night away. We talked about each other, how much life sucked, how bad we wanted away from our hometown and our lives. You know, the usual for teenage gay boys living in repression. I fell for him hard. Too hard. I mean hook, line, and sinker hard. We chatted for maybe a week before he asked me out. I had no problem with dating online. Hell, that was the whole point of me doing this in the first place, so I eagerly said yes. We had only been dating for a week after that or so when he introduced me to the rest of his friends. I met his ex-boyfriend Zachary and their best friend Josie, who I quickly became best friends with, along with about 10 other girls and guys. Josie was a cool chick, and she had known these guys for years. Who better to give me all the dirt on them, right? During the course of the next month, Josie and I became the closest friends out of everyone he introduced me to in what turned out to be a gang. They were mostly just a group of suburban white kids who called themselves the elites and just drank and smoked a lot of weed. I had heard some crazy stories here and there about them beating up and some of them taking the gang thing way too seriously, but I didn't really think much about it. Josie and I had been talking on the phone every single day and really made a genuine connection with each other. She had my sense of bizarre humor, was extremely intelligent, and still liked to have a crazy good time on top of it all. During this period, Jacob and I were doing great, but there was one little problem. I had started to fall in love with his ex, Zachary, the more I talked to him. Jacob could be intense and at times violent when he was angry, from what I heard, but on the other hand, Zachary was his complete opposite. He was too kind for his own good, an extremely caring guy, and he wrote the most beautiful piano music I had ever heard. Being a musician myself, French horn for 10 years, I was immediately endeared to this guy. The more and more time I spent online talking to Zachary, the less and less time I felt like talking to Jacob. Eventually, Jacob kind of figured out what was going on, and to my shock, he let me know he was cool with it and wished us the best. That's how after about 2 months with Jacob, I started dating his ex Zachary. This would be the guy I would date for the next 2 years, and with whom the worst times of my life would be spent. Josie was clearly thrilled for me, and we still talked every day online and on the phone. Sometimes I talked to Zachary on the phone, but more often than not, we would just communicate over AOL Instant Messenger. When we started dating was when everything started to collapse. Jacob, who initially said he was okay with everything, ended up exploding. He completely tore me a new one online and then proceeded to go and kidnap my current boyfriend. Josie called me up, freaking the hell out, saying he'd taken Zachary and no one knew where they were. This clearly sent me reeling from shock. I guess all the rumors I had heard about Jacob were true, and now because of my actions, the guy I'm in love with is in danger. I quickly contacted some of the older guys in the gang and let them know what was going on. Their response was basically, "Ah, not again," which caught me off guard. "Again? You mean this happens frequently?" I talked to Chaz, the leader of this gang, while he sent some guys out to deal with Jacob and retrieve my boyfriend. He basically told me in a nutshell that Jacob has been, and always will be, obsessed with Zachary. That when he gets wasted on whatever, he goes cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs and sets out on some wild mission to kidnap and apparently violate my new boyfriend. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I was in complete and total shock. Apparently the situation was resolved easily, and he handed over my man without too much incident. He also received a healthy beating to remind Jacob that it's not nice to go around kidnapping people just because you can. This was the first, and certainly not the last, incident I can remember where a pattern I'm all too familiar with now would develop over the next several years. Jacob would get drunk and jealous. He would do something completely insane to me or my boyfriend, and then after all the freaking out and worrying was over with, he would come crying back to me, begging mine and Zachary's forgiveness. This became a weekly routine, and it began to wear me out mentally very quickly. Flash forward to around a year after I sent the very first message to Jacob. I was still with Zachary, still best friends with Josie, who I had even been up to Maryland and met in person at this point, unfortunately to miss my boyfriend who was out of town visiting family, and was still dealing with Jacob's craptastic, insane plots to ruin my relationship and give me a stroke before the age of 20. None of this craziness set off any red flags in my head, not one. As a matter of fact, nothing, period, during that entire year gave me second thoughts about anything going on, really. That day-to-day, the-sky-is-falling lifestyle had become the norm for me, and I was used to it. Several of my friends, however, had their doubts, though they were polite enough to keep them to themselves for the time being. This was when the first true danger that threatened me and my family ever arose, and it led to a night I will never forget as long as I live. Katsumi is a 17-year-old who, in the span of 1 year, had accomplished everything he set out to do. I had the perfect boyfriend, even if I'd never met him, didn't care. I had an awesome new best friend in Josie. We'd hung out a few times at that point, and I adored her. And I had joined a group of my own in my hometown. If my parents were going to throw me away just because of who I loved, well, then I was going to throw away every single religious thing I had ever been taught and go to the dark side. I became a Luciferian, otherwise known as a Satanist, and boy oh boy did I think I was hardcore now. Now when it comes to the coven I joined in my hometown, that could fill an entirely different story. Now, I received a call one night around 12 a.m. from Josie, who was almost beside herself, very out of character for her. I mean, Zachary had been kidnapped over 40 times in the past year, and she hardly batted an eye, but this was different. She explained to me that Jacob had really outdone himself and lost his mind this time. He had hired a guy from the elites named Sean to come down to my house and kill me, plus my mother, father, and younger sister. My sister is about 7.5 years younger than me, and from the day she was born, I have always been fiercely protective over her. She was, and still is, my beautiful baby sister, and truly the only one in my household that I loved at the time. When I heard that my ex had taken it so far as to hire a hitman to come after my family, I flew into what we around here call a mountain rage. It didn't matter to me if someone simply came after me, but to target my precious sister who had nothing to do with any of this was the boiling point for me. And even though I despised my parents at the time, I'm still a Southerner, and when you mess with a Southerner's family, then all the crap you're fighting about goes right out the window. Complete and total defend the homestead mode kicked in. I asked Josie when he left Maryland. She told me she found out that he started driving towards my house maybe an hour ago, and as soon as she found out, she called me immediately. Okay, so that meant I had at the most 6 hours to prepare, and at the least possibly 4 if he got a good head start. She also informed me that Sean was a former army guy, but got kicked out for failing several psych tests and being a complete sociopath in general. I'm not a big guy, and at the time I weighed even less than I do now. I was 5'7", and maybe weighed 130 pounds soaking wet, but my first thought didn't require brute strength to beat back this attacker. I called up my coven leader Brandon, who lived not even 10 minutes away from me, and explained the situation. I told him I needed to borrow his favorite toy, and I promised to bring it back in good condition with as little blood on it as possible. He agreed. About 30 minutes later, I was back home in my room, cleaning and loading an extremely nice over-and-under pump-action shotgun. Like I said, no brute force required. I called Josie back up and got the details on exactly what he and his car looked like. Then around 4 a.m., I told her I would call her back and crept out into my front yard. Now, for people who have never been to my house, they always got where to park at wrong. They always ended up in front of my house down a hill instead of in the driveway on the side. This little detail was stuck in my mind and probably saved my life. In the very front of my yard there was a huge oak tree that was big enough for my skinny, girl jean-wearing emo self to hide perfectly behind. All I had to do was wait and hope he did exactly what I thought he would, I got so lucky. He parked exactly on the opposite side of the big tree I was hiding behind. I heard a car door open and someone step outside of the vehicle, shortly followed by the unmistakable cocking of a 9mm handgun. While that sound may have struck fear in the hearts of others, it absolutely enraged me to the core. So I replied in kind with a sound of my own. As I stepped around the side of the tree, he was directly in front of his car, gunned down by his side. In one motion, I simultaneously pumped a shell into the chamber of my shotgun and raised it directly with his head about 10 feet away from me. This caught him off guard and completely by surprise. I didn't hesitate. I simply told him the God's honest truth. I said, "Buddy, you got one of two options right now. You can either get back in your car, turn around and drive straight back to Maryland without stopping, or you can so much as flinch in my general direction, and I will splatter your brains all across the yard. You have 5 seconds to decide. What's gonna be?" I kid you not, the most sickly smile spread across the psycho's face, and for a moment I thought we were about to reenact the movie Tombstone. Fortunately, he had much more of a sense of self-preservation than I thought someone who had just drove 8 hours to kill a family he never met would have. All he did was give a little chuckle and said,
"You're a cold dude. See you around."
He then walked backwards very slowly, my gun following him the entire way, got back into his car, and just drove off. Right then and there, I made up my mind. I had to tackle the beast head on. I was always raised that if you have a problem, be a man and take care of it yourself. I had to go to my enemy Jacob's home turf and bring this war to his doorstep just like he brought it to mine. It was time to go to Maryland. After all the drama of nearly being murdered by a nutjob, I'd really had enough of Jacob's BS at this point. I got online and cussed him out until a fly wouldn't land on him, making a point to let him know that his little plan backfired. He wasn't dealing with some poor little boy that couldn't fend for himself, and each and every crazy situation that evolved had made me stronger as a person, if not a little bit more mentally disturbed every time. I told him he was going to regret the day he ever crossed me and my boyfriend. Instead of apologizing like usual, his true colors finally came out. He laughed at me. He freaking laughed at me. He told me I was cute when I was angry, and said what a dang shame it was that I didn't have a bullet hole in my head. He wished that I was dead and that he never spoke to me in the first place because he was still in love, more likely insanely obsessed with his ex, my current boyfriend of a year, Zachary. He informed me that the war was just beginning, and he would do everything in his power to win Zachary back like he was some kind of adorable trophy you won for baking the best freaking pie at the county fair. I was incensed, completely livid and brimming to the edge with fury. I told him to watch his back, because I'm coming for him. I called Josie and told her everything that happened and asked if I could come stay with her for a week. She excitedly agreed. Zachary was asleep for this whole ordeal and blissfully unaware that anything had happened. When he found out the next day, I think he was even more angry than I was. Fortunately for us, the gang leader Chaz liked Zachary a whole hell of a lot more than he did Jacob, so he hatched a plan with him. The idea was for them to kidnap Jacob like he had Zachary so many times before. They would be accomplishing this task while I was on my way up to Maryland, and when I got there, he would be mine to do with as I pleased. You can imagine the 8-hour drive up there, all the hideous and heinously brutal ideas that were going through my mind. I was going to inflict maximum amounts of pain on the guy that had caused so much in my own life, and I would relish every second of it. Unfortunately, or fortunately depending on how you look at it, my dreams of reviving the Spanish Inquisition on my ex's head never came to fruition. When I arrived in Maryland, Josie came skipping out to greet me, happy as a lark like always to see me. She had some good and bad news. I always asked for the bad news first, and the bad news was that Jacob had gotten tipped off by Kenny. God, I freaking loathe that guy, always meddling where he didn't belong, that everyone was coming for him. He made a hasty retreat and had intended to kidnap Zachary and take him on the run too. But that was the good news. Before he could get to him, Zachary had hopped on a bus and headed to New York to stay with his mom while things cooled off. As sad as I was that once again I had missed seeing him for the first time,
I was just relieved he was out of harm's way, safe and sound. Again, no alarm bells going off that for the second time that I had made the trip up there, Zachary was not around. Josie called him on her cell, and he apparently picked up his mom's, because he never had his own, and we got to enjoy one of the rare times we actually spoke on the phone. All was well. Now for a week of fun and plotting on what we were going to do to Jacob the next time he reared his ugly head. Later on that week, Josie wanted to drive down to an old colonial part of Maryland and go ghost hunting on these abandoned railroad tracks. However uneventful that may have been, we did end up inviting Sean to go with us. Turns out Psycho Dude actually felt bad. Well, almost. He blankly told me that if I didn't have the balls to stand up to him, he would have killed me and my whole family for just $500. Instead of killing him on the spot, which every fiber in my being was telling me to do, I decided to play nice and get him on my side. That way if Jacob ever tried that crap again, he would definitely tell him no because I'm the cool dude. Sometimes you catch more flies with honey. Anyways, the rest of the week was normal and a damn good time. Josie and I said our goodbyes and we parted ways, wishing each other a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. The next couple of weeks was semi-normal, no word from Jacob at all, not even a peep. What a gift, I thought. I'll take it. Year two of my relationship began quite happily, believe it or not. Even my birthday month of January was an unusually good one. Then came the next couple months. 2 months which quite vividly live within me to this day. They also define my life for the next several years. This is when the sky stopped falling, and my world completely crumbled from beneath me in utter devastation. At the beginning of February, Josie had a sudden and urgent impulse to get away from her parents. Now I could completely understand that, so I happily agreed to let her come stay down south with me. I borrowed my best friend's car and drove 15-to-16-some-odd-hour trip all the way to Maryland and back. My parents were less than thrilled. They told me she couldn't live in the house with us. So I said fine, and shelled out my money to a local La Quinta Inn, where she and I lived for almost 2 weeks before my parents caved and let us back at my house. Now, I forgot to mention something extremely important earlier about boyfriend Zachary. He was very sick. I mean, terminally ill, but we thought it wouldn't be for years. I was told he had cystic fibrosis and he needed a double lung transplant in order to live much longer. He was hospitalized in the beginning of February and rushed up the transplant list because his condition was so grave. I can't even begin to tell you how after the year we'd been through together how badly I wanted to be by his side. Unfortunately, he was at a hospital in a part of the country that specializes in treating cystic fibrosis and was way too far for me to travel. Josie kept me in pretty good spirits about the whole thing. She had a lot of experience with cystic fibrosis since her sister died from it several years earlier. She reassured me that since he was so young and tried to take such good care of himself, that he would probably receive donor lungs very soon and be just fine. I tried not to worry too much, but in reality I worried myself sick. Losing him after getting him out of harm's way so many times before was not an option in my mind. How could we overcome so much only for him to succumb to this disease? Zachary and I talked constantly when he felt like it, and even though he was scared and alone, he said he felt like $1 million knowing I was supporting him with my love no matter where I was. That made me feel wonderful being able to comfort him from so far away, and for a couple of weeks my comfort seemed to be doing the trick. Until one day. That day. My boyfriend died suddenly on February 14th, 2008. His lungs filled with fluid, he suffocated, and died. There was nothing anyone could do. I was completely and totally lost. Josie broke the news and I collapsed into the biggest mess you've ever seen in your life. She was still living with me at the time, so she tried to console me as best as she could, while she was shedding her own tears at the loss of her best friend. That forever ruined Valentine's Day for me. To this day it only reminds me of loss and death. You don't realize how fragile your heart truly is until you've experienced a loss like that. Little did I know that even worse moments in my life were about to occur about a month later. I was headed on a course for total destruction, and still blissfully unaware of the one person who had been driving this crazy train from day one. Skip forward to March, St. Patrick's Day to be exact, a little over a month since Zachary had passed away.
Josie had forcefully been returned to Maryland by her parents, seeing as how she had practically ran away. I was off in la-la land of booze, drugs, and more pain than either of those could cover up. I was chilling with my Satanist posse, doing what all normal American teenagers do on St. Paddy's Day, pretending like we're Irish and testing the limits of alcohol poisoning. My alcohol tolerance back then was ridiculously high, so I had already drank an inordinate amount when my phone rang. It was Josie. I slurred my words as something to the effect of, "Hey, girl, what's you doing?" came bumbling out of my mouth. I announced to the room it was Josie, to which everyone replied, "Hey." She had lived with us for several months, and love or hate her, she had become an honorary Southerner. The next words out of her mouth once again sent my head spinning off into space and my world into complete chaos.
"Zachary's not dead."
I stopped breathing for a moment, and when I caught my breath, I asked her to repeat that again. She did. Except this time she added the fact that his life had been in danger, blah blah blah, so he had to hide even from me, blah blah. Jacob just had to think he was dead, blah blah blah. I could literally feel my brain dripping out from my ears as my mind turned into mush with every word out of her mouth. Then for the real kicker to my drunken mental meltdown, Zachary got on the phone. Sure enough, it was his voice. He apologized for what he had to do. I apologized for what I was about to do, which was scream and yell my lungs out, throw my phone into a wall, smashing it into a million pieces, and then proceeded to go from super hammered drunk to completely insane. I drank everything that wasn't nailed down. Who knows what other drugs I did on top of that, because I sure don't remember. I was literally having a complete and total mental breakdown. The last strand of sanity in my brain just snapped. I did this for a couple of more hours until I somehow drove back home, put on my work clothes, and tore out of the parking lot to go to my job in a city half an hour down the interstate with people chasing me trying to stop me. I don't recall any of what happened next, but apparently this is what I did. I showed up to work completely wasted and got fired from my good job. I called my father, freaking out in the parking lot of said job. He realized I was drunk and told me to stay there and he would come get me. Oh, how I wish crazy drunk me would have listened. Instead of doing that, I started driving on the interstate again, not caring if I lived or died, and obviously not caring about anyone else. According to the police report, I was tearing down the interstate at 130 miles per hour. I apparently hit 2 mile markers on the side of the road, and blew out both my right-hand tires, but continued on driving with sparks shooting 50 feet out of the back of my car. I took the exit to the hospital going that fast and spun out, completely totaled what was left of my car. According to bystanders, I then proceeded to exit my vehicle and run across the damn interstate towards the hospital with people chasing after me. Once I got to the ER doors, I heard the now familiar whoop-whoop of a police cruiser. I was so arrested for driving under the influence. I blew a .2 about 12 hours after I had my last drink. If I had blown a .21, I would have gotten a felony charge. That led to years of failed drug tests, violated probations, and ultimately a year in jail down the line. After that, I decided enough was enough. These crazy people from Maryland and their insane concept of living could all go to hell for as much as I was concerned. It had been nearly 2 years of torment, fear, and unimaginable pain. Worst of all, it was starting to cost me my mind and my freedom. I was done listening to Josie and ready to start listening to my actual friends in town who had been begging me to stay away from those people for a long time now. Some good friends sat me down and started to tell me the inconsistencies in all their stories over the last few years. At first I didn't want to listen, but then eventually there was too much evidence not to listen. Finally I opened my ears and my mind on what was really going on. I decided to figure this out once and for all. I got on my MySpace, Facebook, and every other social media I could think of. I typed in Josie's full name into the search bar of every single one. What I found to this day still makes me want to turn my stomach contents inside out. There on every social media possible, by using her name and the few email addresses I knew she had, I found dozens and dozens of accounts linked to her emails. Duplicate after duplicate of Zachary's full name on accounts with pictures of her, and the same thing with Jacob and every single solitary other person in the supposed elites. That's when it finally, after years of denial and torment, finally freaking hit me like a railroad car full of bricks. My God, she's every single one of these people. She's absolutely and unequivocally made up every single solitary one of these people and has been pretending to be a dozen or more people for over 2 years. As you can imagine, my jaw hit the floor. Thank God I had some close friends there who kept me from falling apart and helped me find every single fake profile she had ever created. I was dumbfounded. Profile after profile after profile that had her pictures, but the names of people I thought were entirely real. Prototype accounts before she ended up making the actual fake accounts. Gags or jokes to her, really. In fact, all of this had been one big, insane, psychotic joke. I was too shocked to be enraged yet, but don't worry, that's coming. I diligently copied every link to every single one of her profiles in my AOL Instant Messenger, and then I called her.
Hey, how are you? I'm all right, I guess. Just bored. You? Nope. Definitely not bored over here. Get on AIM chat and I'll show you something really interesting.
I was nearly hysterical at this point, and I could tell she knew something was up. When she was online, I simply asked her, "Hey, Josie, what are these?" Then I sent her the link to every single fake profile she had ever created in her miserable life, and a few from email accounts I didn't even know belonged to her. The silence on the other end of the line was deafening as I heard her clicking through link after link. Her 2-year-long mental game was over, and she finally realized it. Her words?
"Well, man, guess you got me."
She then started to laugh, genuinely laugh as though something remotely funny had just occurred. I don't recall what I said, but apparently it was bad enough for my friends to take away the phone and have to hold me down. Catfish the show or movie wasn't around way back then, so I had unwittingly become one of the first hardcore victims of a stalker in the internet age. Worse than that, I had talked to, lived with, and even befriended the girl who had been stalking and trying to ruin my life for over 2 years. It was literally, and still is, the single biggest plot twist I have ever had in my entire life. Thousands upon thousands of messenger conversations, hundreds and thousands of hours of phone conversation, countless amounts of cash being spent to drive up several states away just to stay with my psycho stalker every single time. Even bringing her down to live with me for months, having $5,000 mysteriously vanished out of my bank account, everything was starting to make sense. There was no Jacob. There was no Zachary. There was no gang. What there actually was one completely insane girl with more mental problems than could fit in an encyclopedia. She was the only person I ever talked to. She was the only person I ever saw. And even worse, she was the one that paid Sean to come down to my house with a gun and try to kill my entire family. Josie was the only person in these last 2 years that had orchestrated any of this, from all the fake kidnappings and boyfriend drama, to faking the death of someone I had fallen in love with and bringing him back just to screw with my head. Who does this? All the events of the last 2 years came flooding into my mind as I realized in each and every one it was solely her and no one else but her. So many questions raced through my head, the least of all being, why me? I deleted my MySpace and made my Facebook private. I only accepted friends that I knew were real. I fell completely off the wagon and out of my head. Drugs, alcohol, and more drugs. That's all I could do to cope. Here I was, a gay man that had unknowingly fallen in love with a straight woman, and regardless of whether or not I thought it was a gay man, which I wholeheartedly did, that still messes with your head pretty bad. I didn't think I could ever be close to someone again. My world had been rocked and ruined. To this day, all these years later, I still don't trust people. I don't think I will ever be able to trust someone ever again. Can you blame me? She came down here. You heard me right. She moved into my sister town not even half an hour away from me. I bumped into her by accident and we started talking. Again, as much as I wanted to stomp her in a bloody pulp on the ground, you catch more flies with honey. I wanted answers. Hell, I deserved them. I told her I was trying to forgive her and I needed answers to my questions in order to do so. I asked her if she would sit down with me and tell me everything, and she reluctantly agreed. I politely informed her that this forgiveness was not for her, but it was for me, so I could stop holding on to and living in the past. I explained she nearly killed me, ruined my life, and what she did was the most personal and horrific thing one human being can do to another, especially after I was so damn good to her. She was polite and let me get what I needed to get off my chest. I tried to be calm and not rude so she wouldn't run away, and I did get closure somewhat and answers to everything. Here's her explanation. Take it with a grain of salt. It started out as a joke when she was in high school. There was a girl who was being mean to her and bullying her, so she thought she would get back at her by getting her to like a guy online and reveal the awful truth later. She had made a bunch of prototype profiles and eventually almost 20 profiles in total, so it looked like this group of people had the same friends and they were real. She just pulled pictures off of freaking Google. She knew none of them were people in real life. She was having a good old time tricking this girl, when along comes a spider to mess up her web. Me. She said she thought she would just mess with me a bit and let me know she was actually a girl, but after talking to me, she unintentionally fell in love with me. Whether that's true or not, I don't know what to believe. If she really did love me, then why put me through pure freaking hell for 2 years? She said she wanted to tell me a million times, but it just got out of control, and before she knew it, she was really getting into being these people and somewhat believed she was them, and they were real. Again, this chick is the world's best liar I've ever met, so who knows what the truth really is. All I wanted to know was how did she get the music, and how did she sound like a guy on the phone? The music, as she shockingly demonstrated to me, was actually hers. She's an amazing pianist and guitar player. I saw this with my own eyes and heard it with my own ears. Zachary's voice in the phone wasn't very complicated. Paid a guy friend a few bucks to be in on it, which this jerk-off eagerly agreed to. Ruining someone's life for a few bucks. How sweet. Sean was all her. She paid him 500 bucks to do that, and she had zero explanation as to why. She knew he would do it. He's just as much a psycho as she was. The rest of it was pure fantasy and imagination, all dolled up to be extra crazy so I would care more about Zachary and give her more attention. As lie after lie was finally revealed and the truth brought to life, I had heard enough after around 8 hours of this. I'd heard everything I really ever needed to hear and wanted to. My life was nearly destroyed. My family nearly killed. My mental and emotional health left scarred forever, simply because she wasn't getting enough attention in her life. Neither was I when all that started, but I didn't go about like a human wrecking ball trying to make myself feel better. I'll never be able to comprehend or understand the mind of someone like that, people who derive pleasure from other people's pain and misery. I'll never be able to fully trust, not in the way that's required of a true partner and companion. I just can't do that again. If I'm morally betrayed again, I know the next time will kill me. So as I write this in my apartment a little over a decade after it all happened, I'm alone. One good thing did come from this. It sure as hell made me the person I am today, and it strengthened and toughened my resolve into tempered steel. I learned to be okay with myself and to finally love myself after so many years of self-loathing. I'm a pretty amazing person. I don't need a man to define my life and who I am in any shape, form, or fashion. Obviously, I'm worth something. Otherwise, this psycho chick wouldn't have latched onto me for years and ended up moving 8 hours away from her home to be 30 minutes away from me all this time. What she stole, I will never get back. But what I gained, she can never take away from me. Again.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its
Eagle staff. FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura, and I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. Mm. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Ripura nenge no wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida, ashike kapeno nweko tite opoye ekukulile. Oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo, ihewe tike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM, otuna evi toda njuka, okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa. Nune udo, otukwetira o special ange, tashake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka, opone ushendife nawa, nukumona oijabo ili nawa, ninge kwa tafano na Monica ko Eagle FM, onora etatu imwe bali heali, nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile konderewa, nora etatu natu, bali o etatu watatu, omafilane Eagle FM, the eye.
Alrighty, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about catfishing, and we're talking about the horror stories that occur through catfishing. So now you guys see the pattern, right? Basically, it's just some auntie that is just playing you on the internet, or some dude that's just playing you on the internet, non-existent whatsoever, and they are just who they are. And the last guy's story was a bit wild. It was intense, like, whoa. And what about when the catfish becomes a stalker? And it is terrifying. Like we were saying, that it is internet interactions, right? And part of the internet interactions is not only like the gram, the face, the all of that. It is more about also Tinder. Now, if you don't know, if you're not familiar with Tinder, Tinder is a dating app where basically they match you with people around your specific area that has basically the same interests as you do, and also maybe a few things in common. I'm not familiar, you know, most. I'm not familiar, but I do know that is the gist of Tinder. So everybody's always happy, you know, when you're matched up with somebody and they're actually serious and they meet, and then, you know, they come to us and lie to us that they met in the grocery store, or they met at church, and they come and tell us all these things, and we're like, wow, can't it was Tinder? And then they delete their profiles, and it is what it is. I think that even if you check somewhere there might be a profile of me. You don't know. You don't know. You don't know. And looking for love everywhere. Yeah, it might be there. I don't know, man. I don't know. Maybe 10 years ago. I don't know. But all in all, they are stories. And I'm telling you these stories not because I want to scare you out of anything. I want to teach you the dangers. I want to show you the dangers. I want you to hear what other people have gone through so that you can choose whether or not, right? You're going to go through with it. You're going to look for love on the internet, or you're going to look for love the good old fashioned way. Okay.
Hello, I'm Melissa Doyle. This is Sunday Night. Dr. Angela Jay is truly remarkable. She's been through absolute hell, been face to face with evil, a crazed stalker determined to destroy her. But it began quite innocently. Just like thousands of other women, Angela went online on Tinder looking for a soulmate. And for a while there, she thought she'd found him. But she was wrong. So terribly wrong.
That's how someone thinks that.
He wanted to destroy me.
Someone thinks that.
All right, are you with them now?
We need police. We need police.
We'll get them there for you. Are you with the patient now?
Yes, we are.
It wasn't good enough to take my life and take me away from all my friends and family. He had to physically actually destroy my body as well.
This is the story of a woman's worst fear.
He was going to force her to have sex with him. Tie her up. He was going to strangle her, pour petrol on her, and then kill her.
He wanted me to be ruined for anyone else.
The nice guy she met on Tinder before he turned bad.
Wow, just, I'm blown away. Absolutely blown away.
Is the offender still nearby?
Well, we don't know.
The neighbour who risked his own life to save her.
I heard her scream and I was going in there one way or another. He would have got it. I just felt absolutely invincible that day. The adrenaline was just unbelievable. It's just, you know, I would have just done anything.
And in spite of the horror she's been through, the determination of this young woman to help others like her.
I have, in some ways, no choice but to be a strong woman and make a difference.
Angela Jay was a young, hard-working doctor delivering babies. She was based at Port Macquarie on the New South Wales mid-north coast.
You know, bringing new life into the world and, you know, passing a baby onto a new mum and her partner and seeing that look in their eyes, like, it's just beautiful. And I couldn't see myself doing anything else.
She grew up with her single mum, Susan.
She's a very caring woman. She's just absolutely magnificent girl. So proud of her.
And her sister and best friend, Danielle.
She's such a strong individual. She knows exactly what she wants. She's incredibly caring.
In her early 20s, Angela married Ben. Not long after, he joined the Navy. But their busy lives soon pulled them apart. So at 27, she began to look for a new man.
Do you believe in love? I definitely believe in love. It's just that, you know, magical feeling that you get and you just know that you have that deep connection with someone.
And like many young women, she tried the popular dating app Tinder.
It just basically comes up with people in your area that fit the criteria that you've set, basically making a decision about the vibe that you get from that person based on a few photographs.
It's like winning the lotto, actually finding someone on there that actually is compatible with you.
Pretty soon, Angela found a potential match, a 36-year-old insurance manager.
Your first impression when you came across Paul Lambert on Tinder, what did you think?
In his photos, he looked just kind of like a normal guy, had, you know, looked, you know, pretty handsome in a couple of photos. So I was like, yeah, we'll, you know, have a chat and see where this goes.
You said that you, when you matched, you were both after the same thing. What were you after?
A serious relationship, basically.
Soon, Paul Lambert was travelling from his home in Sydney to Port Macquarie to see Angela.
I think after our second date, it basically came up that we both had been married before and that it didn't work out. We were ready to settle down again and, you know, just find that life partner.
Paul had recently moved from Brisbane and, strangely, had changed his name from Paul Scales to Paul Lambert. But on his Facebook page, he had plenty of friends and he seemed to be a kind uncle taking his nephews fishing.
What was he like?
He was very charming, very attentive. It was, a lot very early on. Like, it was all very fast in that he, you know, wanted to take me out to dinner straight away, was funny, seemed very intelligent, seemed to be driven at work. Basically, was ticking all the right boxes that you would look for in a potential partner.
Before long, Angela was ready to introduce him to her family.
This tall, good-looking, very confident, well-presented man walked in with the most amazing bunch of flowers I've ever seen in my life.
I actually messaged her and gave her the tick of approval, and I said, I'm so happy you found Paul. He's great.
I just said to my husband, oh, my God, he's a breath of fresh air. He's such a nice man.
Call it male intuition, but Susan's husband, Bill, wasn't so sure.
He shook his head within 5 minutes of meeting him. He said to me, there's something wrong with him. And I said, you're very unkind saying something like that when you've just met somebody. And he said, no, Susan, we're going to be picking up the pieces down the track with this mark by word.
At first, his intensity seemed sweet, but soon it was all too much. Angela, feeling smothered, decided they had no future and attempted to break up.
He was extremely upset, was crying, he just seemed a bit broken. I kind of felt guilty that, you know, have I led him on, you know. It's an awful feeling hurting someone.
But Paul just wouldn't accept it was over.
He started threatening to kill himself and telling me that he was going to jump in front of a truck. I think I started to feel worried about my safety as well. She was hiding the fact that he was mostly blackmailing her, that he was going to end his life if she were to break up with him.
To keep the peace, Angela agreed he could come to her school reunion here in a sports club on the Central Coast.
In the end, I agreed, okay, you can come, but you just need to just act very normal. I don't want you to make a scene. I didn't want someone's life on my conscience.
But at 1 a.m., Angela's friends called her sister Danielle to come and collect her.
She was just a mess. She was absolutely in tears. And there Paul was yelling at me. I was worried for him and what he was potentially capable of, and worried about my personal safety as well, and that I really just wanted to get away from him. So in the space of a 10-minute drive, I had heard that she's getting emotionally blackmailed, that he's going to kill himself, that he's bashed his ex-wife, that he's not supposed to be in New South Wales, and he has a criminal record.
Suddenly, it was clear this was not just an intense man brokenhearted.
And those are things that people don't tell you, like, hey, I've got a history of violence and I've got a criminal record. I'm just saying.
It started to escalate.
I received a message from a man named Dan, who was claiming to be his good friend and that he had witnessed him try to kill himself, that he had run out onto the street and a truck had swerved and missed him. Obviously, I was very confused, but I immediately felt very guilty.
Angela had no idea that Dan was in fact Paul himself. Finally, a worried Danielle insisted they go to the police.
I put in his name, Paul Lambert. Boom, criminal history. He looked us dead smack in the eyes and goes, this guy is known to police very well, but he's more of a threat to himself than to you.
Angela drove home, 4 hours north to Port Macquarie. But Paul Lambert was not giving up.
That Sunday, Lambert arrives by plane from Sydney without telling Angela. He hires a white Corolla, telling the clerk, I've had an argument with my girlfriend and I'm here to make amends.
He wasn't going to take no for an answer in this relationship. I said to her, please give me a call when you get home and make sure every single lock is locked on those doors and every single window is secure.
Sunday afternoon, Lambert comes here to Angela's house, unannounced and carrying luggage. He has a loud argument with Angela, overheard by the neighbours.
He was there waiting for me at my doorstep. So I gave him his things and told him to leave my property and that I never wanted to speak to him again ever, and that I don't want him to contact me, and that I don't want him to come to my house or my workplace. I never want to see him again. He was scaring me, and I told him, you're scaring me, and I just really want you to go away.
Lambert has disappeared down this laneway between the houses.
Angela calls the police to tell them what's happened and asks for an apprehended violence order. Lambert has left, but he's far from leaving her alone.
Started sending me basically threatening text messages saying, you're not safe in your house. I have stolen some of your keys. I was just sitting in my house afraid, not knowing what to do. He sent me another message saying, you need to go to your neighbor's house. Which terrified me. I how do you take that? So I, of course, ran to my neighbor's house and knocked at their door and somehow tried to tell them, like, look, there's a man that I recently dated who I think is thinking about hurting me. She started talking and sending all these texts that this guy had sent her. Then she'd called the police and the police were on the way.
I just had this sixth sense there was something going to happen to this girl.
Next,
I was so ashamed that I was in this situation at all. I just felt like I couldn't tell anyone.
Paul Lambert ramps up the pressure.
I heard a noise and I woke Angela up. And I said, what the hell is that noise?
And gets ready to strike. She doesn't know that hiding in the walk-in wardrobe of her bedroom is the man planning to rape and kill her. Dr. Angela Jay has come back to work here at Port Macquarie Base Hospital. She's hoping Paul Lambert has left town, but he's stalking her every move. On Monday, we now know Lambert checked into the Rotary Lodge for families and friends of patients. He pretended he had a sick friend in the mental ward. It's right across the road from where Angela was delivering babies. She's hoping Paul Lambert has left town, but fears he won't give up.
I considered telling my work colleagues what was going on. Maybe not in full, but at least enough to say, oh, hey, don't stress or anything, but if I don't show up to work, you should probably call the police.
Watching from Rotary Lodge was Paul Lambert. In room 17, police later found empty cigarette packets, fruit and drink cans with Lambert's DNA. He'd clearly spent a lot of time peering out of this window, watching Angela's movements to and from the hospital.
I was so ashamed that I was in this situation at all. I just felt like I couldn't tell anyone. Like, I'm a doctor. I'm going to be an obstetrician. I care for people. I don't need to be taken care of. I can take care of myself. I fix things. Like, I don't need help.
But Angela's mum, Susan, is worried.
I walked into work that morning. I walked straight up to my boss's office and I said, I need some time off work. And he goes, why? And I said, I need to go and spend some time with Angela. I fear for her life.
Mum basically came straight up to Port Macquarie and stayed with me for a few days and cooked me meals and took care of me.
But Lambert started bombarding her with dozens of calls and text messages.
This is my good side. The good side won't last long. Especially being rejected.
I literally thought about driving somewhere in my car and sleeping in my car for the night. I thought about going to work and sleeping in our on-call room. I thought about even showing up to emergency and faking to have appendicitis or something.
Susan and Angela barricade themselves inside the house.
Me thinking I could control the situation had figured out which keys were missing, and I actually unscrewed all of the actual locks and doorknobs from all of the doors that it could lock and kept all my windows shut all the time. It was very stuffy in my house, kept all the curtains drawn. I was afraid to look outside. I just basically tried to lock myself in.
On the Tuesday night, I heard a noise and I woke Angela up and I said, what the hell is that noise? And she goes, oh, it's probably just the cat. And I said, the cat's on the bed. I said, the cat wouldn't make this noise. What was that noise?
On the Wednesday, Lambert came here to the local Bunnings. He bought a hammer and a crowbar. He also armed himself with cable ties. He clearly had trouble on his mind. Next day, Angela's mum, Susan, has to head back to Sydney for work.
My biggest regret is leaving and going back to work on the Thursday. Because that's the day he struck.
Here at a local Caltex service station, he bought 5 litres of petrol in a jerry can. All the while, Lambert watches and waits. So unhinged, he talks about himself as another person.
For the last 4 days, he has stalked her. He has followed her. He has waited outside her house and waited outside her work. He has waited for the opportunity.
We now know Paul Lambert stalked Angela for days. In this nature reserve at the back of her house, it was easy for him to slip through the bushes unnoticed, over her back fence, and quietly break into her home.
Thursday, I came home. The blinds in that front window were up, and I saw a bloke standing there with no shirt on, and I thought it was a bit odd.
I just felt really calm. I can't explain why. My cat, Armani, was still at my house and Mum had left some food at my house. So it was daytime. I thought, look, I'm just going to quickly duck home, quickly have some dinner, feed Armani and grab some clothes. And then I'll go to my cousin's house.
Angela gets home from the hospital around 5. She has spaghetti for dinner and watches a bit of TV. She doesn't know that hiding in the walk-in wardrobe of her bedroom is the man planning to rape and kill her. Coming up...
He raised a big rectangular can over my head and started pouring petrol over my head.
The frenzied attack.
I was just terrified that any second I would go up in flames.
And a hero comes to the rescue.
He heard this almighty screaming. And then I knew there was something horribly wrong.
It's 6 o'clock at night. Dr. Angela Jay heats up some of her mum's spaghetti. Down the hallway, Paul Lambert is hiding, silently, in her bedroom. Angela has her dinner in front of the TV. And then...
I just needed to grab some clothes from my bedroom, which is at the very end of the house. So I started walking down that way. And as I was turning the corner to enter my bedroom, he jumped out at me. And I screamed, obviously. And he put his hand around my mouth so that I couldn't scream. And looked me in the eye with a really intense look. He said, it's okay. I just want to talk. He got me when I was... actually busting to use the loo. And I was trying to process what had just happened and buy some time. So I said, look, I really need to use the toilet. Can I at least do that? So he allowed me to, but had the door open and watched me. I was shaking uncontrollably and just trying to think what I could do. He then told me to sit on my bed.
And-
As Lambert interrogates Angela about who she's been staying with and whether it was a man, somehow she gathers her wits and her courage.
I realized that I had to try to get away or die trying, because I wasn't going to just sit and wait around to find out what he wanted to do to me. So I just made a run for it. He, of course, caught me. And then I just suddenly saw this knife in his hands. And I didn't actually feel him stabbing me, but I could see the blood when I looked down, and I just thought in my head, oh my God, he's actually stabbing me. He's gonna actually kill me. And I was so scared, and I felt so alone. And that I was just gonna die in this big house, stupidly, that I should never have gone back to. And that I'd never see my friends or family again.
At that moment, neighbor Steve takes his dog outside to go to the toilet.
And then we heard this almighty screaming. And then I knew there was something horribly wrong. Grabbed this steel bar that I've got in there for work and bolted down that driveway.
I managed to stand up. But then he grabbed me again. And then he raised a big rectangular can over my head and started pouring petrol over my head. My eyes were burning, and it got in my mouth, and it got in my ears. And I can't even explain the horror you feel when you know that somebody is trying to set you on fire. I was just terrified that any second I would go up in flames.
Ran down this driveway, and when I got to the top here, I could hear someone thundering down the hallway. Like, it sounded like a herd of elephants.
I think it made me a little bit slippery, so I somehow got out of his grasp and just ran for the front door.
I got about 15 foot from the door, and the door opened and Angela came running out. All I could smell was petrol.
I just kept saying over and over again, I'm going to bleed to death. I'm going to bleed to death. Please call an ambulance. I'm going to bleed to death.
I know I had my arm around her and I dragged her up here and went straight up into our garage, which the garage door was up.
Once I'd seen them come out, then I ran inside. Then I got the phone. Because Dad's saying, where's your phone? Call the ambulance.
Yeah.
Steve's daughter Amy and another neighbour, Brendan, both call 000.
Is there any serious bleeding?
Yes, there is.
Is she completely alert?
Yes, she is.
And what part of her body is injured?
Her leg and her arm.
Her upper or lower?
Yes. Upper arm and her leg.
We came up here and Amy was over that side and yeah. I was here. And I put this over here and Angela was laying right here with her face to me. She was very, very calm. She stayed very, very calm and collected and gave us a few instructions, I think. Amy ran inside and got some pillow slips and towels.
Dad had a towel wrapped around her leg up here.
There's a lot of blood. She lost a lot of blood, yeah.
My face was just burning. My face burned. And I could just, all I could smell was petrol. So I asked Steve to find some water to wash off my face.
I didn't realize till I got her up in here, and I could still smell petrol, that she was covered in petrol. My lunchbox was just there, and there was a bottle of water in there. I washed her face because it was burning, because it was red.
I was holding her hands and talking to her, and I was holding her back, saying, "You're doing awesome," and things like that.
And then the ambulance arrived, and I was just so happy to see them. And they were so lovely and were so great. And I'm sure I was being a very difficult patient because I just immediately started bossing them around.
At the back of Angela's house in his white rented Corolla, Paul Lambert flees the horror he's inflicted. But extraordinarily, he now begins to make a series of phone calls. As Angela is being rushed to hospital, Steve, who's in the ambulance with her, answers her phone.
I said, "Who is it?" And then he said, as calm in the calmest voice, "How is she?" And then I knew, I thought, holy shit, this is the bloody bloke that's done this.
I didn't mean to do it, you know.
I was just calling it an effing bastard. I said, "How the effing hell do you think she is, you effing bastard?"
Then Paul Lambert sends text messages to Angela's mum, Susan.
They were cruel. Absolutely cruel.
What did he say?
I tried to stop him. He was talking as though he was a third person. That he tried stopping him.
In his car, heading north out of Port Macquarie, Lambert is now on the phone talking with police.
He was going to force her to have sex with him. And then he was going to tie her up, and then he was going to strangle her.
He talks about the attacker again, as if it's someone else.
He's going to pour petrol on her and kill her.
Detective Senior Constable Sean Durbridge tries to persuade Lambert to give himself up.
"I'm concerned about you. I don't want you shot. I don't want you hurt."
"No, mate. No, I need to take my own life."
In his disturbed state, he's slipping in and out of talking about himself as another person.
"No, I saw the evil today. I watched it happen. I watched it in my own head, and I wasn't strong enough to stop it.
Do evil things."
"Well, you're talking pretty rational at the moment."
"That's because I'm me. I don't know how long I'm still going to be me."
Calmly, Lambert warns that police should guard Angela.
"All right, you need to make sure that I can't turn up there."
And her mother and sister, because his alter ego might attack them.
"You need to get a police officer to her sisters and mums, because I know they live on the Central Coast."
Then he asks how Angela is.
"Is she alive?"
"She's alive."
"Just want to talk to her, all right, and tell her that I'm so sorry about what happened to her. I tried to stop it, you know? She's never going to speak to me."
"Can I meet with you? Have a talk?"
No, mate. No. I need to take my own life."
Paul Lambert ends the phone call, but police have used his mobile signal to track where he is, now 150 kilometres north of Port Macquarie. Here at the Archfield Station Road overpass, highway police are ready. They fling spikes in front of Lambert's car, bringing him to a halt. As Lambert jumps from his car, he pulls a knife. It's clear he won't surrender peacefully. Coming up, Lambert's final showdown with police.
Lambert emerges with a knife, threatening police. They try to taser him, but it fails.
and his darkest secrets revealed.
Paul Lambert is a monster, and he'll always be a monster in my eyes.
As Angela is rushed into hospital in Port Macquarie, 2 hours after the attack, Paul Lambert is fleeing north on the highway when he's stopped by police.
Lambert emerges with a knife, threatening police. They try to taser him, but it fails. Lambert then runs 500 metres, brandishing his knife. Two police officers shoot him down, firing many shots. Paul Lambert is dead.
He was gone and he couldn't hurt me anymore or come back to get me one day. It was a huge, huge relief.
And when we walked into the hospital, Angela said he'd been shot dead. And you just don't even know how to react with something like that. The relief more than anything.
Almost a euphoric sense, like, you know, I somehow got away and he's gone. I don't have to worry. Like, I'm well and truly safe.
Safe, but badly wounded. Angela has 11 stab wounds to her body. Remarkably, within weeks, she was back at work delivering babies.
She's so strong, physically and mentally. She was strong enough to fight off a 6-foot-something big man and get away. And then strong to reassure her family the night of almost being murdered that it's going to be okay.
My daughter doesn't have to worry about this monster any longer because Paul Lambert is a monster. And he'll always be a monster in my eyes.
But somehow this monster had a charming side. Just months before, with football legend Wally Lewis, he'd raised $50,000 for an old school friend.
I had some State of Origin tickets to the stadium and thought, I'll just try and raffle them off.
He ran a remarkable internet campaign to help buy an assistance dog for his friend's autistic daughter.
Wow, I'm blown away. Absolutely blown away.
Yet this same man had a dark history of stalking and violence against a series of young, attractive women as far back as 2003.
Yes, I am Paul. One of 9 personalities. I have all memories of others, and none of the others have mine.
In 2015, he was deported from the United States after stalking a former girlfriend, TV reporter Anne Keel. A year later, he was charged with assaulting his then-wife, Samantha Inkpen. A Brisbane psychologist who saw him 17 times diagnosed him with borderline personality disorder and as suicidal. But he said he had not lost his ability to understand right from wrong.
I'm a psychopath at times. Other times, I'm normal.
I don't think he was intending on me surviving. But I think he wanted me to be unrecognizable, and I can't really think about it because I just can't fathom how someone would feel that way about someone else.
For Angela, survival has given her a new sense of purpose.
I feel like I didn't die for a reason, and that I now am here to make as much of a difference as I can and to help as many people as I can.
Next, the scars remain.
I don't cover them up. They remind me what I've survived and what I've been through.
And that is why we say the internet relationships are extremely dangerous, because you don't know who is on the other side. We don't know who is on the other side or what conditions they have. I think in the 21st century, part of the questions that we must ask on first dates or when we start talking to people is, hey, can I see your hospital card? Can I see your hospital card? Can we go for psychological evaluation before we get this thing on the road? Can we do that? So that you don't end up with some person that has run away from several countries, right? Because they've got issues. And it's not everybody, and I'm not stigmatizing, it's not everybody that is like this, but for those that are, wouldn't it be safer to be safe than sorry?
Angela begins a new life.
I'm determined to make something positive come out of this.
Five months on, Dr. Angela J has largely recovered physically, but emotionally, she's still fragile.
Are you starting to feel stronger?
Yeah, sometimes I'll feel like I'm kind of moving on, and then the next week I might feel a bit down again, so it's a bit up and down at the moment.
May I ask you about your scars? Mm-hmm. Do you cover them up?
No, I don't cover them up. They remind me what I've survived and what I've been through. And I will carry them forever. I have no choice. So I've chosen to think of them positively as much as possible.
Angela's shocking experience has inspired her to join White Ribbon, the national campaign against domestic violence.
It's serious hiking, guys.
To raise awareness, she's training for White Ribbon's Trek for Respect, a week-long hike on the tough Larapinta Trail in the Northern Territory.
I'm really looking forward to hopefully breaking a sweat and hopefully not too many tantrums along the way.
With Angela on the trek will be her dad, Steve, and her brother, Zach.
You're a 19-year-old young man. Why is it important that you support White Ribbon?
It's actually men taking a stand, and I think that's very important, especially for, you know, what happened with my sister.
It's so great to do something with Ange, and it's, you know, it's like every day that I can spend with her is a gift.
Yeah.
To do it with White Ribbon, and really you're out in what's a very sacred part of Australia.
Hey, here's cheers then. Here's your trek.
Yeah,
cheers. Cheers. Good luck. Cheers. 65 cheers. Pounds.
Yeah. She is casting a light on women's role, standing next to the men's role in this campaign, to talk about the issue of violence against women, to understand how it happens, and to better engage men in driving change so that we can prevent this from happening in the first place.
Angela hopes more men will stand up, like her neighbour, Steve Wilden.
You know, she was so brave, like, and I was channeling all the strength from her.
He tries to brush it off as anyone would do the same thing, but I know that's not true. It takes a special person to suspect something serious is happening behind closed doors, and to actually take action and to try to help that person.
Like Angela, it's taken Steve a while to recover.
I didn't sleep for 2 days.
Or eat much.
Yeah, no, nah, just didn't eat or sleep. Didn't even have a beer.
Which is not like him.
Nah. Yeah, shook me around the first few days, I tell you, yeah.
You know you're a hero, don't you?
Oh, I don't see that way, no. I was just in the right place at the right time, and in my eyes, she's a hero, not me.
I think it's pretty impossible to come out of a near-death experience and not try to find some sort of spiritual meaning behind it.
Somehow, this survivor is still full of hope for a family of her own.
One day, I'd definitely love to have, you know, that special partner that's there to support me. And, you know, if I'm having a bad day, will make me feel better when I come home and will hopefully take the lead with raising the children.
I'll be like an interrogator with the next person Angela goes out with.
You and Danielle together?
Yes. There'll be an interviewing panel.
Being out on the water, does it heal you?
I think so. I think the sea and the ocean has a very powerful cleansing ability, and I think it kind of represents life in a way. There's some days that it's very rough and stormy, and then other days it's very peaceful and beautiful, and I can't help but feel really happy and at peace whenever I'm on a beach.
Angela still has her bad days, but it's been an astonishing recovery. Somehow, she's emerged stronger and more motivated than ever. And surprisingly, there's no room in her new life for bitterness, not even about online dating sites like Tinder. She says she was just unlucky. You'll find more about Angela's story on our website and Facebook page. Stay on 7 now, and thank you for making us part of your Sunday night.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its
staff. Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not a fraud, it's a scandal. Scandal. Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my candidature. Menace,
right?
Because I grew up in Katatura, and I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM.
Ipurane ngeno wapubwa eva tere ulikoni maundu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite opoye ekukulile oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano hile koshiwana onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka okukwetira oipindi konu kwa ndado ilinawa nune udo otukwetira o special ngetashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamo ilinawa ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile kongerewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafilane Eagle FM the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Bonjour, my little penne à chocolate, tu es superbe. I just said you're my little chocolate croissant, and you look superb in français. You're welcome. Crime, conspiracy, serial killers, cults, and murder. Did I say that wrong?
So this story starts with a girl named Jessica Sayers. And Jessica lived with her grandmother Mary in a sleepy hometown of Weybridge in Surrey, England. Surrey, England. I'm not going to try to do accents through this whole thing. I'm not going to put you through that. But anyway, she was just a normal 15-year-old girl. She had friends, and she liked makeup, and she loved going to the movies. As you do. You know? And when she was 15, she became really good friends with a girl named Alice. And we're calling her Alice in the story, but that isn't her actual name. I'm just saying that to
Litavazende kize, imba izwezipiri. Luekerize mikwaye nguyencha kukona kunolofaza, kwa nkufisa, hamo chualo ni mata amsika vwana kare. Kana mitukiserize kuvona msevelezo wa imba ye, mufumane lisevelezo ze izwezipiri ze, kakulipa fela mashiringi alika na $36 million kakweli. Kapa, kami kwaye kutesi fafasi ye tatama, 5% machipisa, hamungo lisari kwerize talu, 10% machipisa, hamungo lisari kwerize sirela, 25% machipisa, hamungo lisari kwerize lishumiteri. Muketeri kwerize zo muvata kuri mukone kukala kuikola zendezeo imba imiswalezi fama chipisa. Imba, toku vukaniri fasi kaufela. Mwipe kwa lisevelezo za imba kachenu kuri mukone kuikola zende kaufela.
Protect her identity. But anyway, we're going to call her Alice. So Jessica and Alice became really good friends, but they also became really good friends with a girl named Gemma Barker. And although Gemma was 2 years older, they all liked the same things and enjoyed each other's company. And actually, Alice was friends with Gemma before she was friends with Jessica. So Alice introduced Gemma to Jess, and they all kind of became friends, and it was really cool. And what they liked about Gemma is that she was 2 years older, and because she was 2 years older, she could drive. So they were able to go anywhere, anytime, and they loved that freedom. So they all got really close, and this was a time way back when MSN and Facebook were things that were actually popular. It was 2009. So Gemma, Jess, and Alice really enjoyed hanging out together, but they also enjoyed hanging out with each other online via message boards on MSN and Facebook and so on. And you know, as girls do, they talk about boys they like, who they like, whatever fits your fancy. And Alice and Jessica were really wanting boyfriends, so they were kind of always talking about that online and with Gemma. And then one day, Alice would get a friend request on MSN. And that friend request would be a guy named Aaron Lampard. And Alice would take some cautionary, and she would see who Aaron's mutual friends were, and she would see that he actually had a lot of the same mutual friends as her. So she thought he was also cute, and she accepted his friend request, and they started to chat. And over a couple months, Alice and Aaron would get really close, and Aaron would start complimenting Alice and clearly showing that he was interested in Alice. And Alice would pay him the same compliments because she saw pictures of him. He kind of wore baggy clothes, but he had a really cool look about him. He was always wearing a hat, and she thought he was like really handsome. So she was feeling really good about this potential relationship. And at this point, she hadn't been in a relationship, nor had Jessica or Gemma, really. So she was the first one to really start talking to a guy. So they would keep talking and talking, and then one day, Alice actually realized that Aaron had a mutual friend that she was really close with, and that was Gemma. So Alice would actually be with Gemma one day, and they would start to talk about Aaron. And she said that she actually knew him really well. Gemma said that she knew him really well, and that she would actually hang out with his older brother, and actually really liked his older brother as well. So she kind of vouched for him. She's like, yeah, he's actually a really cool guy, and like, it's cool that you're talking to him because I already know his family and they're awesome as well. And Alice and Aaron hadn't met in person yet, so Alice kind of felt that validation that she could keep talking to him and that it wasn't really weird because one of her best friends knew who he was. So feeling encouraged by one of her best friends, Gemma, she would continue chatting with Aaron online. But not too long after that, she started to want more. She started to want to meet Aaron in real life, put a face to the name. You know, she knew what he looked like online, but you kind of don't know, and you kind of want to, you know, meet him in person, which is fair. But Aaron would be a bit standoffish to begin with. He would kind of constantly make up excuses not to meet her in real life. But eventually, he realized that if he didn't meet her in person, he might lose Alice. So he decided to meet her. So they would get online and plan to meet at a park near Alice's house. And Alice would get ready, and she was nervous and excited, and she walked out the door ready to meet the man of her dreams. And when she got to the park, she would see a boy standing there in kind of dark baggy clothes, wearing a toque or a beanie for new Americans on top of his dark brown hair. And when he turned around, she would be happily surprised by how handsome he was. But she didn't see that coming. You thought he was going to be like some weird old freak, but he wasn't. He wasn't. Aaron was a handsome young man. So they would do that little awkward icebreaker conversation and get to know each other, and then they would go for a walk in the park, and it went really great. And a couple weeks later, after meeting several times, Aaron would actually ask Alice to be his girlfriend, and she would happily say yes. So it's 2009, like I said, and Alice and Aaron are in a steady relationship, and she obviously is talking about Aaron, her new boyfriend, to one of her best friends, Jess. And Jess, seeing Alice so happy, is, you know, very happy for Jess, her friend. And she insists on meeting this boy of Alice's dreams named Aaron. So Aaron and Jess would start talking online as well. So Alice and Aaron are together. You gotta stay with me, okay? There's gonna be a lot of people introduced in this story, so I'm just gonna keep telling you what's going on. So there's Aaron and there's Alice. They are together. And then there's also Jess, and then there is Gemma, who is Alice's friends. Okay? We have that. Maybe make a thing up here. Alice, Jess, and Gemma. And then we have, you know, Aaron down below is her boyfriend. Okay, hopefully that makes sense. And hopefully for the listeners, God bless you. Hopefully you follow along, pay attention. But anyway, so Alice's friend Jess is now talking to Alice's boyfriend Aaron. Just as friends, they're getting to know each other, they're becoming friends. And they would start to talk every day. Almost as much as Alice was talking to Aaron, Jess would talk to Aaron, either by message on MSN or Facebook, and even on the phone. And Jess would eventually deem Aaron as one of her boy best friends. And Alice is obviously one of her girl best friends. So they kind of became this really close-knit group. Meanwhile, Gemma actually started dating Aaron's older brother, Jack, during all of this time. So Gemma now has a boyfriend named Jack, and Alice has a boyfriend named Aaron, and Jess is currently single but is friends with everyone. So Alice would talk to Aaron, and Aaron would talk to Jess, and Jess would talk to Alice, and Gemma would talk to Alice, and all that stuff. But anyway, one day Alice was talking to Gemma, and she was asking him about Aaron's family because she hadn't met them yet. And Gemma was saying that they're super nice, and she would even show her pictures of Aaron's family because Gemma was dating Aaron's older brother Jack, so she had met him plenty of times. And Alice would start to really want to meet his family, so she would ask Aaron if she could meet his family. But it seemed every time she asked, Aaron would come up with some sort of excuse. Nothing too crazy, just like, you know, he didn't feel well or something came up. But then tragedy kind of struck his family, and she felt bad for asking because one of his brothers ended up drowning in a terrible accident. And not long after that, one of his other brothers would get diagnosed with leukemia. So Alice kind of felt bad at this point. She didn't really want to pry, so she stopped asking to see his family as much, and they just continued their relationship. And she ended up being a shoulder for Aaron to cry on, and they kind of comforted each other during this time. So Alice and Aaron would continue their relationship, and Jess was friends with both of them, same with Gemma. But Aaron was kind of feeling bad that Jess was left out. She didn't have a boyfriend, and she really wanted one because he was talking to her a lot, and she was explaining how she was she was really happy for Alice and Aaron. But, you know, she really wanted love for herself. And Aaron said, well, I have a friend, actually, and I think you'd actually really like him. And this friend's name was Luke Jones. Okay, add it to the thing. Put it up here. I don't know where we are. I think Jess is over here. So Jess, Luke Jones, for now, all right? So Jess would get introduced to Luke online, of course, as you do during the time, and they would start to talk. And Luke would be very flirtatious and funny, and he would pay Jess a lot of compliments, and she just loved that. Luke was, like, so her type. And after not a really long time, they would agree to meet up in person. And they would meet up in person, and she would think he was super cute, and one meetup would lead to two meetups, would lead to three meetups, and so on. They really hit it off. off. And Jess would say when she first met him and after she met him that he appeared and spoke very chavvy or chavvy. It's English slang, if you will. And it means a boy or a girl that always seems to wear designer or sport clothes. He wore snapbacks a lot and Air Forces and hoodies and tracksuits. He was really like suave and stylish guy, this Luke Jones. He was a lot different than his friend Aaron, Alice's boyfriend, but she liked him a lot nonetheless. So both Jess and Alice would continue their relationships with Luke and Aaron, and Gemma would kind of fall to the wayside a little bit because she was having a full-time job at this point, and she was also dating Aaron's older brother Jack, and she was older as well, so they were starting to kind of drift apart a little bit, but we're still friends. But cracks started to form in the new budding relationship between Jess and Luke. They continued their relationship through 2009, and naturally, they got closer and closer, but Luke got a little too close. See, this was Jess's first boyfriend, and she wasn't completely comfortable with going further than, you know, hugging and kissing, but Luke was starting to pressure her into doing more stuff. Going as far as to put his hands down or up her skirt and going further than that, and Jess did not want to do that. And Jess would even tell him to stop on multiple occasions, but he would not stop. So he essentially SA'd her. And this was heartbreaking for Jess. This was her first boyfriend and she really did like him. He really was nice besides those moments where he was making her very uncomfortable. And unfortunately, Luke would go off and actually have relations with another girl that actually went to Jess's school and she would just be heartbroken and they would break off the relationship for good and she would not see Luke again. And Jess would even make this known on Facebook saying, "I hate you both. You're welcome to be each other, fucking dickheads." I like that. She does kind of sound like that too. But fair enough. Fair enough. Luke's an asshole, right? So Jessica is heartbroken and upset, and her good friends Alice and Aaron are trying to comfort her at this point. But before too long, she gets another friend request on MSN, and that friend request was from a guy named Connor McCormick. So let me just put this up here. Okay, so Alice is still with Aaron, right? Gemma is still with Jack, okay? And now Jess was with Luke, but now Luke is gone, all right? And now there is Connor McCormick. Got it. Just wanted to make that clear. So Connor had been mutual friends with Luke and Aaron, and he had seen the post from Jess calling Luke out for cheating on her, basically. So he would reach out to Jess saying that he knew Luke, and Luke had actually told him everything that he had done to Jess, and he felt really bad for Jess. So Connor thought that was awful, and he would tell her that she didn't deserve that, and she deserved a lot better, and that's when a friendship would blossom between Jess and Connor. And they would become closer and closer as weeks went on, and they would kind of start to form a relationship of sorts before even meeting each other in real life. And from the photos, Jessica could see that Connor was a really, like, stylish, good-looking guy. He wore skinny jeans, had that swooped, shaggy hair, and always wore a cap on his head, and he wore, like, button-up shirts. He kind of looked like a knockoff Justin Bieber. And at the time, Jessica really loved Justin Bieber, so she was kind of like, this is the perfect guy for me. So in January of 2010, they would meet in real life for the first time, Jessica and Connor. And they would meet under a tree near Jessica's house. And Jessica would say that he dressed slightly different when she met him in person than from the pictures she saw online. And he wore a beanie or a toque for my Canadians. And he would wear a hood over his beanie or toque. And he kind of wore more baggier clothes. But from what she could see of his face, he was handsome nonetheless. And this would be how he would always dress. Just kind of almost like covering himself. But Connor would say that he wore this hat and hoodie like this because he had alopecia. And Jessica actually had a brother with alopecia, so she kind of understood why he would feel nervous to show himself, because it made him uncomfortable. And for those of you who don't know what alopecia is, it's basically a general term for hair loss that can occur in many forms and for a variety of reasons. Basically, he just had really bad hair loss, and he was embarrassed of that. So Jessica totally understood. But one thing that was kind of strange about Connor is that he didn't talk. I mean, he didn't physically talk. He actually texted. Like when they were in person, she would talk to him and he would write out a text and show it to her or send it to her on her phone. He never actually spoke. And he would say on text, obviously, to her that it was because he was violently shy. He was just a very shy guy. So he seemed to have, you know, a plethora of issues that he was dealing with himself, or a bunch of demons he was dealing with himself. But Jessica was very sweet and understanding and understood this, and she would keep on seeing him and keep on falling in love with him more and more. And one day he would actually give her a necklace and officially ask her to be his girlfriend, and Jess would say yes. And Alice obviously thought that Jess's new boyfriend, Connor, was a little bit strange for not talking to her, but she was supportive nonetheless, especially since Connor was kind of mutual friends with her boyfriend, Aaron. And Connor and Aaron actually both lived in the same neighborhood, which was called St. George's Hill. And it was basically just a really well-off community. It was like footballers and celebrities lived in this community, and they both lived in this community. So it kind of was even more of a reason for these girls to be attracted to these guys, because they came from very affluent families, Connor and Aaron. But Jess and Alice hadn't actually been to their houses. They would always just kind of hang out around town, but they would always kind of meet them near that gated community of St. George's Hill. So while Jess was getting into her new budding relationship with Connor, Alice was getting more and more serious with her boyfriend, Aaron. So much so that they would start a physical relationship in the bedroom. But Aaron, in this situation, would stay mostly clothed, like fully clothed, basically. And also, he always wanted to do it in pitch black, which Alice thought was normal because this was her first boyfriend as well, and she didn't really know any better, so she just thought that that was normal. But one day they were hanging out, and Aaron would ask Alice to grab keys from his bag because he needed it for something. And Alice would naturally go over to Aaron's bag, and she would see a pink dildo in the bag, which just threw her off completely and freaked her the freak out, because she had never seen one before, but it was plainly, you know, a dick in a bag, you know? And Aaron would say that he did actually use it one time while they were sleeping together, and Alice was completely taken back and confused by this, and she asked to just, like, have some time apart, because she was like, whoa, what the frick? Like, you gotta talk to me about bringing that shit into the bedroom. Like, I should know this stuff, which is completely fair. So she's like, okay, hold up. Let's take a minute. Let's take a break. Meanwhile, in May, Connor would have a tragedy in his family, and his nan would pass away. And he would ask to stay over at Jess's house for comfort. And at this point, Jess and Connor hadn't really had any sort of physical relationship together. They've just kind of hung out, you know, hugged, kissed here and there, but they have not, you know, been together in any sort of way. But Jess would obviously say, yeah, of course, I just need to ask my nan. So Jess would ask her nan if Connor could come over. And given the circumstances, Jess's nan was a little bit reluctant. She's like, I don't know about this guy. You know, that's a little inappropriate. Like, you guys are only, you know, 15 years old. That's a little weird. But she would say, it's okay. And she would, quote unquote, say, he better keep his pecker in his pants, which I think is hilarious. So Connor would make his way over, but he would tell Jess ahead of time to tell her nan that he had lost his voice because he didn't really want to talk to her nan, because he's never talked to Jess, let alone her nan. So he's like, make up an excuse for me, because I don't want your nan to know that I just talked to you through text, because that's weird. So Jess would cover for him and tell her nan that. And her nan just kind of already sussed him out and was like, that's weird. But he would come over and he would just kind of grunt.
Because that's the suspect, right? But we're talking catfishing here, so okay.
To Jess's nan, and Nan would ask him a bunch of questions, and he would just be like, and he would point over to Jess's room and go, and then her nan was like, yeah, all right, go to her room, like, you're fucking weird. So she was feeling uneasy about Connor, but, like, she knows that he just went through a death in his family, so she didn't really push, and Jess and Connor went into Jess's room for the night. So Jess and Connor are in Jess's room, and they would, you know, do what teenagers do. They start hugging and kissing, and then Connor would begin to undress Jess, and Jess would ask him to stop, and that's when he would begin to SA her. It was just Luke all over again, her last boyfriend. Like, Connor was just doing the same thing. And Jess would continue to plead to Connor to stop, and after asking a bunch of times, he finally would. And very, very soon after, Jess would get a call on her phone. And this is where we started to get really weird. She would see that Alice was calling, and she would pick it up and say, "Hey," and Alice could tell right away that something was wrong with Jess, that Jess was clearly upset. But before Jess could say anything to Alice, Connor would grab the phone and say, or text, he would text Alice on Jess's phone that Aaron had got in a horrific car accident. And Alice was horrified reading this. She hadn't talked to Aaron since the whole, you know, dick in a bag situation, so she's like horrified. And then Connor would say that he went through the windshield of the car and that he was on life support in the hospital. And Alice is just like horrified, and Jess is like, "Oh my god, that's horrible." And then Connor would just be like, "Yeah, isn't it a shit situation, mate? Yeah, it sucks, doesn't it, mate? Anyway." And Alice and Connor would have, you know, a little bit more of a conversation about everything they just talked about, and they would go to bed. But Jess was naturally way too upset to go to sleep, and she was feeling extremely suspicious of Connor at this point with all the news that he just gave Alice. And he didn't tell Jess beforehand, she found out when Alice found out, which was weird. And then the whole, you know, essaying thing was pretty f***ing terrible and weird. So she turned over in bed to look at Connor, the one who was always wearing a hoodie and hat, kind of down and over his face. And at this point, his hat was a little bit up, and she could see more of his face. So when she turned over to look at Connor, she figured out that she was looking at the profile of Aaron. Aaron is Alice's boyfriend, who Connor just said was in the hospital on life support after a car accident. So let me set this up right now, okay? We got Gemma and Jack, or whatever the fuck his name was. And then we got Alice and Aaron, and then we got Jess and Connor. So Aaron was pretending to be Connor, and he went to Jess's, and he essayed her and he lied to Alice about him being in the hospital, himself being in the hospital as Aaron, but he was pretending to be Connor. Does this make sense? I think it does. I feel like it does. And if you can't follow along, just restart the video. I don't know what to tell you. Okay, so Jess turns over, she looks at her boyfriend Connor and realizes that it's actually her friend's boyfriend, Aaron, and she's freaking out. She's horrified, obviously, as you would be, and she doesn't know what to do. So she's kind of catatonic, thinking about all of her options, and she's like, "Okay, I'm gonna pretend this never happened at this point, and in the morning, I'm just kicking him the fuck out. I'm not even telling him I know, I'm just kicking him out, and I need to think." So that's what she did. The next morning, super early, before her nan was even up, she's like, "Get the fuck out," and she had enough reason after he did what he did that night, you know, and she would kick Connor slash, you know, Aaron out the door, and she would never see Connor slash Aaron again. So Jess is, you know, just going about her day, trying to put together everything, and she hadn't talked to Alice yet at this point. Alice went to school, and after the whole day, Alice is worrying about her boyfriend, Aaron, who's supposed to be on life support at this point because of the horrible car accident that he didn't get into. And then her dad pulls up to pick her up from school, and who's in the car? Aaron, her boyfriend, is in the car, and he doesn't have a scratch on him. So Alice is like, "What the fuck?" That Aaron had been in her bed last night. And that's when Jess would go to the police and tell them that Alice's boyfriend, Aaron Lampard, SA'd her. And, you know, Alice was beside herself, horrified that this happened. And they're putting the pieces together, Jess and Alice, and they're like, "What the frick is going on right now?" So in their minds, Aaron is this lying sack of shit, right? So the police would naturally go to Alice's house to question her about Aaron. But who's at Alice's house? Aaron's at Alice's house. How convenient. And Alice would just tell Aaron to give them the hospital records at this point, because she knows now that Aaron was lying to her about being in the hospital. She's just kind of putting him on the spot, being like, "We'll just give the police your hospital records, and then they can clear you that you weren't in Jessica's bed last night." And he was like, "Oh no, I can't find the hospital records, even though it was last night. I can't find it." And he just kept making these excuses. Meanwhile, Luke, Jess's previous boyfriend, her first boyfriend, posts on Facebook at this time, quote unquote, "Hello, I'm sorry to say that
thing with Jess, that was me. I did it because I wanted her to hate Connor. And in another post, he said, I want people to know it's me because Erin is getting the blame for something I done, and I think that's not right. So Luke was taking the blame for what Erin had done, or sorry, what Connor had done, but it was actually Erin. So Luke, Erin, and Connor are all, like, shitnicks together. Like, who was actually in bed with Jess that night? So the police, confused as ever, as I'm sure you all are, and I am, honestly, were, like, unable to find Luke at this point. And they were like, who is Luke? And that girl's name was Gemma Barker. Gemma was pretending to be three different guys, her friend's boyfriends, who essayed her. Are you caught up? Here, I'll do the thing again, all right? We have Gemma, Alice, and Jess, okay? Gemma's dating Jack. Jack doesn't exist, right? Gemma was Erin, who's Alice's boyfriend, and Gemma was also Luke, who was Jess's first boyfriend, and Gemma was also Connor, who was Jess's second boyfriend. So she literally pretended to be three different guys, and her friends did not realize that their boyfriends were their best friend. Okay, so her plan was completely revealed and foiled at this point. And Alice and Jess, people who were supposed to be friends of Gemma's, were absolutely shocked and horrified. Because they thought for months from November 2009 to May 2010 that these three separate boys were boys, not their good friend Gemma, disguising herself as a boy and having relations with them. Like, how could, like, that doesn't even make sense. And a lot of people, you know, scrutinized the girls, being like, how could you not know that it's your best friend dressed up as boys? But they were like, who would expect their best friend to dress up as boys and pretend? And he and she would do a very good job of pretending to be boys, going back to the beginning in, like, the perspective of Gemma. So basically, Gemma was friends with Jess and Alice, and through the relationship, since he was 2 years older, she would actually go off to college, and she would start to get kind of separated from Alice and Jess, and she would be kind of jealous of their friendship, and she would want them to be friends with her more and more. And whether she was dealing with, you know, some sort of sexuality confusion, or if she just wanted to manipulate them single-handedly, I'm not sure, but she conjured up a plan to become the perfect boyfriends for her friends, because she knew everything that both Alice and Jess loved in boys. She knew that Jess loved Justin Bieber, and she knew that Alice loved guys that, like, had a lot of swagger to them and liked certain sports and everything. So she literally was able to create these boys who were perfect for her friends, and she was able to disguise herself, and she worked so hard on making her voice sound like a boy's voice, but she didn't want to use that voice too many times because she was already using it for Erin and for Luke. So by the time she got to Connor, she's like, I can't keep talking in the same voice. So she literally just didn't talk as Connor at all. And when she went too far with Jess as Luke, she realized she needed to, like, get rid of Luke completely and become Connor and be somebody different. But then she would end up falling into her essaying and disgustingness all over again, because it's terrible. There's no excuse for it. And then Erin, who was Alice's boyfriend, who's actually Gemma, would use that, you know, dick in a bag to pretend that she was a boy. Since she was in pitch black, she could literally pretend that, you know, dick was hers, and Alice didn't know the difference, because again, these were their first boyfriends. They were completely in the dark with all of this. So Gemma was able to manipulate them for months and months and months, and they didn't know better. I mean, they knew by the end that something was suspicious AF, but for her to be able to manipulate them for that long is, like, insane. And even after Gemma got arrested, she tried to keep up the facade by saying Luke, the guy she pretended to be, beat her up and assaulted her. But obviously Luke isn't a real person, and it wasn't true, so she would end up getting charged with fraud on top of the charges she got for sexual assault on her friends. And in 2012, Gemma would plead guilty to 2 counts of sexual assault and 1 of fraud. And then she would be sentenced to 2.5 years in prison, which is kind of like 2.5 years. Like, that's nothing. That's nothing.
But I mean, I guess she was, at this point, I think she was 18. She was 2 years older. So, but yeah, I think she should have got more, because that's like, that's crazy behavior. That's psychopathic behavior. If you ask me, like, Gemma exploited and manipulated these two girls, girls who trusted her as a friend, and because of either jealousy or sexual confusion or just straight up deceitful manipulation, she did all these things without thinking of how it would affect her friends at all.
It's wild. It's wild. Imagine your best friend is going to, but I also don't understand. How will you not notice that your friend is dressed up like a boy? Mara, it is what it is. So I'm just saying, be careful of the internet. Be careful of people. Be careful. Be careful. Be careful. So I'll see you again tomorrow at 1 p.m.